Foreign Policy Association.
I read that fellow's report.
Standish, yes.
I think he's full of prunes.
Well, that's the way we used to talk in the 1930s, Noah.
Standish?
The London Times man in Berlin.
Yes, of course, he was quoting rumors mostly. Men drilling by night, underground meeting places, pagan rituals.
Do you believe him, Paul?
Well, anything's possible.
I'm sorry, sir, but I think it's ridiculous. Huh? Well, there may be some fanatics, but no German in his right mind can still have a taste for war.
Do you know Germany, Mr. Rankin?
I'm sorry, I have a way of making enemies when I'm on that subject. I get pretty unpopular.
Well, we shall consider it the objective opinion of an objective historian.
Historian?
A psychiatrist could explain it better. The German sees himself as the innocent victim of world envy and hatred conspired against, set upon by inferior peoples, inferior nations. He cannot admit to error, much less to wrongdoing. Not the German. We chose to ignore Ethiopia and Spain, but we learned from our casualty list the price of looking the other way. Men of truth everywhere have come to know for whom the bell tolled, but not the German. He still follows his warrior gods, marching to Wagnerian strains, his eyes still fixed upon the fiery sword of Siegfried. And in those subterranean meeting places that you don't believe in, the German's dream world comes alive, and he takes his place in shining armor beneath the banners of the Teutonic Knights. Mankind is waiting for the Messiah, but for the German, the Messiah is not the Prince of Peace. He's another Barbarossa, another Hitler.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 2nd of December 2022, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre in Bristol, and on the talkradio.org.uk stream, and at radioquk.com in Camperley, Surrey, and also live, or so many different ways you can listen, aren't there, on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, not necessarily Google. This is what you call marketing, isn't it? Lots of different ways to listen, except I suppose really we need to employ some massive PR company in order to try and rival some of the big networks. Anyway, I suppose the fact that we're so unmarketed is one of our plus points, really. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade Ukraine psyops and the COVID treatment prevention, where Dr. Tess Laurie told us an estimated 60,000 Brits died unnecessarily, and followed by God knows how many more now with the poison death jabs, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution this week. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We're also joined by Ruth Nestor, who has had a bit of an altercation with a local authority here in Bristol, turfing her out of her own home. We'll be also hearing later from Barbara Cook at Bristol Outcry, a human rights group, having a meeting next weekend, and Dr. Judith Brown, who's been looking at propaganda around the whole issue of COVID and other issues. So we will also be looking at the Bristol Clean Air Zone, which came into force this week. Also, of course, there's the whole climate agenda behind it, the whole pro-nuclear climate agenda. Those environmentalists that used to hate nuclear, do you remember them? Well, they've all disappeared because we've got new nuclear power stations being opened up, thanks to them. And if you remember, the big protests at the coal-fired power stations weren't led by environmentalists, no. They were led by the police. The police infiltrator led those protests, not the environmentalists at all. Mark Kennedy was his name. Anyway, there is no climate emergency, apparently, according to Dr. Judith Curry. Yes, of course, there's problems with the climate, but to call it an emergency. Also, Sizewell, as I say, gets its go-ahead, and we'll be hearing a bit from Rosa Corey. I didn't realise had died last year. She's one of the pioneers of pulling apart the whole Agenda 21. Also, in part two, an absolute delight for MI6, a delight for Martin, We've got one of the former head directors of operations of MI6 who just popped up on the TV last week. I couldn't quite believe it. I rushed over to the television, press record. And so I'll be hearing what he had to say and what Martin was saying about him. Obviously, he's talking about Ukraine. And we'll have Rishi talking about his foreign policy. He was at the Guildhall in the City of London on Sunday doing this annual Guildhall, I think, isn't it called the Lord Mayor's Banquet, where he gave his first big foreign policy speech, even though, I mean, it depends what you mean by big, I suppose, doesn't it? And we round up with Whitney Webb and also a look at philosophy and psychiatry and their role in geopolitics with Anton Chaitkin and the New Zealand preacher Barry Smith. So, Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel, and then a few weeks later by Ofcom too. So just take a note of that. It's the telecoms people, the people that own the satellites, that switched off Russia Today and the Iranian channels first, not Ofcom. And now we were cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia and Patrick Hart. But we're not cancelled here quite yet. Anyways, I'm very pleased to be joined by Ruth Nestor. Ruth, you were here a couple of months ago, I think, talking about your eviction. Now, there's been a few developments. Do you want to take us through that?
Oh, yes. Most recently, which was about 4 weeks ago, I was asleep and I just felt my house shaking. It was the NAT bailiffs who were used by Bristol City Council. And Nigel Heath Sinclair, who is Bristol City Council, sold the debt to. And they actually took my doors off the door frame, got into the property, dragged me out of my bed, which I was naked, violently dragged me down the stairs, which caused me to sustain head injuries, widespread tissue damage. I was in A&E several times, and raised blood pressure as a result of the trauma. And
so these bailiffs, who are they again?
NET bailiffs.
So NET, National
Eviction Team.
Now hang on, because I can remember these guys were used at Dale Farm about a decade ago, which was a big gypsy traveller site in London. So they are pretty much like the top-notch bailiffs in the country were used on your house. Why do you think that is?
Well,
I say top notch, but I mean, I've heard chatting to the locals, they say they're a bunch of thugs.
Well, most certainly, I do believe they are a bunch of thugs because they have tortured me in my own home, and the violence that they use was, you know, it was atrocious.
Well, I mean, apparently, I've reading some of the statements that have been made by them to the BBC and other people, you weren't naked, but you made yourself naked in the garden of the house. So how do you answer that? And that's what the bailiffs have said.
Well, they're dishonest in saying such because there's the footage which the IPCC, which is the Independent Police Complaints Commission, are now examining, and they are simply appalled by what they have seen, and that they have told me so, that the level of the torture was atrocious.
Okay, so the other thing which is I've seen, I mean, I've been doing a good old look around because this has made the national news headlines around the country when it actually happened. And another thing that's been said by the bailiffs and by the council is that you had some sort of a debt that you'd managed to accrue beforehand, and so basically they were just enforcing that debt, and you know they're within their rights, so they say taking away your house from you in order to sell that and pay the debt off.
Yes, Bristol City Council actually prosecuted me for my own entitlement for council tax benefits, and there was an overpayment, a small overpayment of housing benefit. But to actually be prosecuted for my lawful entitlement is actually, that is a fraud, and it's fraudulent. And they continue to rack up a lot of fraudulent liabilities against me. And they're using that. In addition to that, they could have made an application within 6 months, and they failed to do so. So the debt is bad and doubtful. They failed to do so within the judicial period, but then they sold the debt, knowing that they have failed under the judicial rules, sold the debt to Nigel Heath Sinclair, who is an insolvency practitioner, who of which the Insolvency Practitioners Association, who regulates him, have said he's acting outside of his regulatory scope.
Well, fascinating. So, but I mean, I mean, my own personal experience of the Bristol City Council with council tax is not good. There was quite a period when I was earning enough where I was paying council tax. I didn't check my bank statements for a couple of months, and I found that the council had been taking out full amounts of council tax out of my account, although I'd written to them and told them that actually my income was down, and therefore I wasn't liable for those rates, and I was a liable for council tax benefits. Not liable, but I mean, they should give me council tax benefits. Anyway, the only way I could stop the council doing that was to actually close the direct debit, shut the direct debit off, because the council was stealing money from me every month on the basis of council tax. Now, Martin, as you know, both of these situations here, we're talking about my situation and Ruth's around this whole idea of council tax. I remember looking up at council tax last week. This is the most regressive tax, basically, in the world.
Well, I wouldn't say it's the most regressive in the world, but it's definitely a regressive tax. It was brought
It's the most regressive tax in the country. I mean, that's what they're saying in Europe.
You've got to think of council tax is actually poll tax mark two. Previously, the local councils in the country were funded under the rating system, which is a property tax, which actually dates back to Elizabeth I. The first rates were put in place in her reign. And though those property taxes were on property, not on individuals. So it was quite straightforward to collect, because if people didn't pay, then you could impound the property and so on. With the council tax, because the poll tax put the onus on individuals to pay, and the whole idea originally was going to be one rate for everybody, and the idea being that poor people, if they wanted services in their area, they've got to pay for them. Why should rich people pay for other poor people's services? And that's what led to the rebellion and the collapse of the Thatcher government.
Well, the reason that rich people should pay for poor people's services is because the poor people don't have any money to pay for those services.
That's the whole concept behind the rating system, which still exists in Northern Ireland, because they didn't dare to change the system, because they realised they've got civil war going on anyway. If you change the system, like bailiffs coming round to your house.
Yeah.
Now, in Bristol, they can get away with that, but not on the Falls Road or the Shankill Road. Bailiffs would end up dead if they came round doing stuff like that. They'd just get shot. And that's one of the and the whole thing about it is that they did modify it in the end so that, you know, you pay according to the level of your property, but it's still cast on individuals, which makes it very difficult to collect, because people at the bottom end of the scale haven't got a lot of money, and even when you chase them down, they haven't got a lot of money to pay.
Okay, well,
so it's a very difficult tax to collect. It's just stupid tax,
well,
really.
It's an impossible tax. It's designed to drive people into debt, I think. And,
well, also to drive them off the electoral register, because people don't register to vote because they don't want to pay.
And to repossess their property, to steal their property, etc. This is a kind of legalised theft that the Labour Mayor Marvin Rees is up to here. So before we get into what the most recent developments have been with your house, Ruth, which is interesting, that's why you're here, because things have happened.
Certainly.
Let's have a listen to the other side. That is, we've got a Rishi Rich, the Prime Minister at the moment, and he was questioned on his massive wealth and whether he's actually in touch with ordinary people at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
And then back, Dobble.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It was sad to see in a video from his Oxford days the future Prime Minister saying he hadn't a single friend who was working class. And he's not likely to make any soon, because while he sits on a personal fortune, he's refusing the reasonable demands of nurses, railway workers and many others forced to take industrial action just to make ends meet. Why doesn't he give them the wage increases they need and fund it by making the rich pay the same rate on unearned income as workers have to pay for their hard graft? And whilst he's at it, why not scrap the non-dumb tax loophole that he's all too familiar with, which is costing the public £3.2 billion?
Mr. Speaker, I've nothing but admiration and gratitude to our nurses for all the work they do. But Mr. Speaker, Mr. Speaker, it is simply unreasonable and unaffordable to have a 19% pay rise. Now, if that's what the Honourable Gentleman thinks is, I'm sure the Labour Party can explain to us how they would pay for that and the impact it would have on inflation. But I tell you this, Mr. Speaker, if he really wants to support working people, maybe he should get off the picket line and end the strikes.
Well, Rishi Sunak is trying to obviously divert attention from the, you know, the question that he's been asked, which is about non-dom status. I mean, it is outrageous. I would argue that if you are a resident in this country, or you are a citizen of this country, a resident abroad, that you should pay all of your taxes. Simple. So it doesn't really matter where you live. If you're a British citizen living in Honduras or Belize, like Lord Ashcroft, who's the chair of the Conservative Party, you still have to pay all of your taxes, even if you claim to be living in Belize, if you want to keep your British citizenship. And if you want to live here, like Rishi Sunak's wife, then you've got to pay taxes on all your wealth. And, of course, that would be quite straightforward to enforce, and it would make a lot of money.
What we seem to have done is we've created the policy, really. It's not just the idea, it's most definitely a policy, that the richer you are, the more you can use that money to avoid tax. So the tax burden is no longer falling on the rich, it's falling on the poor.
Well, that's right. Income tax, if you think, remember, was only introduced, really, in the First World War. Before that, all taxes were on wealth. The rates created by Elizabeth I, we talked about a minute ago, that was a tax on wealth. And that meant that wealthy people had to sell stuff in order to pay the tax. They were expected to do that. And, of course, the rates were used in each parish to keep the poor. And that was the concept behind it. And, of course, there was lots of resistance to the rates from the property-owning classes from the get-go.
Well, what's happening?
But it was a straightforward system, and everybody knew where they stood.
So what's now happening with council tax is that it largely falls on, well, ordinary, on poor people. It's a regressive tax, and it's used to feather the nest of the mayor and the mayor's office.
Well, look,
and so he can go and jet around the world. Because what's happening is central government is cutting the finances to local government, and so all of the various things that the mayor does are now being paid for by people like Ruth.
That's not true, because in actual fact, most of the money spent by local government is actually central government money.
Mm. That's being cut all the time.
Yes, that's right. So in other words,
there's more and more being forced from the poor in
Bristol. Well, that's right. The council tax is going to be allowed to rise in the budget, you know, the recent budget. And so councils will raise it to the fullest extent they can, because they've all got no money, because central government money has been cut. Mm. And it's been cut because we bailed the banks out, we went to war in Afghanistan, we went to war in Iraq, we went to war in Libya, we've gone to war in the Ukraine, and we bailed the banks out, and therefore there's no money.
You mentioned Ukraine there. This was one of the first things that the Poroshenko government did after the coup, is they clawed back massive amounts of money that was going from Kiev to the regions in Ukraine. And they said, well, actually, no, we're going to keep this for ourselves. You have to raise your own taxes. Well, so the British government is mirroring what Kiev did after the coup.
Well, I mean, what's the Ukrainian government has pursued since 2014, its economic policy has been super Thatcherite. There's no doubt about that. And that's one of the reasons why the eastern part of the Ukraine didn't want to submit to that. And I predicted this in the book that I wrote, which was published in 1998 with Laszlo Andor. We said, this is what will happen. The East Ukraine will want to secede under those circumstances.
So we can call you Mystic Martin now.
It's not mystic. It's actually anybody who looked at it objectively would draw that conclusion. And this is why it's happened in the way it has. They've been forcing this free market down people's throats all over the world. You know, I believe your family from Ghana, aren't they?
Guyana.
Yeah, and of course the same stuff has been forced on them, as in elsewhere in Africa and other parts of the world. And it's just, and this policy has been rammed down everybody's throats for decades.
I mean, it seems to me that there's almost like a war between rich and poor coming. So let's have a listen to the Prime Minister's question. Maybe it's deliberate, you know, the idea is to create a civil war. Let's have another listen to Prime Minister's questions, and we'll get back to Ruth, finding out what's been going on with her after this. And this is a similar sort of question to Rishi Sunak, and this time it's about private education.
We mark that tomorrow is World AIDS Day. Mr. Speaker, Winchester College has a rowing club, a rifle club, an extensive art collection. They charge over £45,000 a year in fees. Why did he hand them nearly £6 million of taxpayers' money this year in what his levelling up secretary calls egregious state support?
Yeah. Yeah. Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'm pleased he wants to talk about schools, because we've recently announced billions more funding for our schools. We're helping millions of the most disadvantaged children catch up with their lost learning. And we're driving up school standards, Mr. Speaker. But during COVID, he wanted to keep schools closed. We shouldn't be surprised, because I listen to parents and he listens to his union paymasters.
Mr. Speaker, his levelling up secretary, I see him down there, who, after all, was education secretary for 4 years, said you could scarcely find a better way of ending burning injustices than scrapping these handouts. Yeah, yeah. And here's why, and he talks about driving up standards. Just down the road in Southampton, and he'll know this, 4 in every 10 pupils fail their English or maths GCSE this year. 4 in 10. Is that £6 million of taxpayers' money better spent on rifle ranges in Winchester or driving up standards in Southampton?
Mr. Speaker, he talks about school standards. It's under a Conservative government, and thanks to the reforms of the former Education Secretary, that now almost 90% of schools are good or outstanding. But Mr. Speaker, whenever he attacks me about where I went to school, he is attacking the hard-working aspiration of millions of people in this country. He's attacking people like my parents, Mr. Speaker. This is a country that believes in opportunity, not resentment. He doesn't understand that, and that's why he's not fit to lead.
Okay, well, picking up on a couple of things in there. Of course, what Starmer is saying is that Michael Gove, in the past, has come out and said that the private schools shouldn't be exempt from value-added tax because they're exempt from it because they're educational charities, supposedly. And, of course, many of them were originally set up to educate poor children, but, of course, that's not what they do these days. What Starmer is using, I mean, you know, I think what Starmer's Labour Party would do if they came to power is they probably would abolish VAT, make private education VATable, as it were. But Gove has already said that, so he's picking up on the tension between Gove and Sunak. And of course, what Sunak's answer to that is that he avoided that because he said that Gove, he was commending Gove's educational reforms, which made many, many more schools outstanding. My father was a head teacher he retired in the 1980s. And one of the things that made him absolutely furious was the whole idea of why can't all schools be outstanding? And of course, because it's an abuse of the English language for all schools to be outstanding. And what you've got to reach the outstanding standard. And as far as he was concerned, if schools are adequate, and that should be enough. You know, the inspectorate should be checking that things are adequate, not looking for outstanding. But you can see what they're driving with. It's a competitive mentality that they have. And, of course, they're then talking about Winchester. Winchester is the top, one of the top private schools. Eton and Winchester are the two top private schools.
Not Harrow anymore.
No, Harrow's second rate in the pecking order. The reason why Winchester tends to attract... They call them Wickhamists. It's the more intellectual, you know. If you really want to, to go to Cambridge or Oxford and study science, that's where you go. Of course, Sunak is not really on a very strong wicket here to try and defend his
pop. But it's more of an example, isn't it, of rich versus poor and these two-tier society. Anyway, Ruth, can you just take us through what's happened with your house? Because I understand that you've got kind of reversed what the bailiffs did, haven't you?
Yeah. The bailiffs, they locked me out of the property that I own. And they haven't done so. The mortgage is still being paid. And now... there is a political squad that is in situ, and that has reversed what they have done to me, because now they're locked out.
So are you actually back in the house yourself?
No, I'm not yet back in the house, but Bristol City Council would rather pay £70 per night to house us in temporary accommodation instead of dealing with the most appropriate manner in handling the debt.
So what they say is you have something called the, I think it's called the Proceeds of Crime Act. Now, I don't understand quite how that applies to you and your council tax relief, where I thought the Proceeds of Crime Act was aimed at organised crime gang members, and that was designed to take their assets off them, not Ruth and her house.
Well, that's what Bristol City Council did, because their primary objective was to rob me out of my property, use my vulnerability and my disability to rob me out of the asset. And they prosecuted me for my own entitlement. And having done so, by even examining it, I'm long-term sick and disabled. How am I liable for a large 16,000 debt? And that 16,000 debt, they have used 45,000 of taxpayers' money to actually prosecute me for my own lawful entitlement.
What often happens with local authorities is they will say, OK, you've got this debt, we're going to give you 10 years or something to pay it back bit by bit. Have they offered you that opportunity?
Yes, the courts. I have an order by the court. And because I'm on a low income, the court has given me to pay £5 a week, £10 a fortnight. Now, that order is in place and the order has not been breached. But Bristol City Council...
So have you been paying that?
I have been paying it, and it's paid by standing order. But because Bristol City Council do not actually respect the judicial and lawful imposition of those orders, they've actually imposed Nigel Heath Sinclair on top of that order.
Well, I'm very pleased that some of my friends at Bristol Housing Action have taken your house and taken it back from the bailiff. So I'm very happy. And if anyone would like to come and join them at Ruth's house, or we'll call it Ruth's house, not the council's house or anyone else's house. It's Ruth's house at Robertson Road in Bristol. You can just, what's the number?
It's 54 Robertson Road, 54 Robertson Road.
And the postcode?
And it's Bravo Sierra 56 Juliet Tango.
Right, and if you want to go down there, give BAM a call. That's 07833100399. Bring a sleeping bag, and you can join the protest, because I think this, what's been happening to Ruth could, it seems to me, happen to almost anybody. Ruth has been singled out and targeted and bullied in this fascistic fashion by Bristol City Council and its wonderful, marvellous Marvin the Mayor, the so-called Labour Mayor. And whatever you make of this story, it's absolutely not right for Ruth to have her house taken off of her in this fashion because of some dispute about whether she's entitled to or not entitled to council tax relief. And also, as we've just heard, the courts having enforced an order saying that she can pay the money over a long period of time. She's doing that, but the council have just completely ignored that and riding roughshod over the law. And as happens sometimes in these cases, the only way to force the issue when the law is abused by these insolvency companies is to force it back to court again. And I guess that's where. So where are we at with this at the moment?
We're at the situation where Bristol City Council, they're trying to airbrush themselves out of the whole story because they're refusing the editors of Bristol Post, refusing to attach their names to these stories.
Well, that's right. They've got a very tough PR policy at Bristol City Council. The woman who's in charge of PR there doesn't like to have the brand of Marvin Rees and the brand of Bristol City Council besmirched. So they just refuse to comment in a lot of cases. And in fact, they've even stopped sending council press releases to the press. Because they say the press have not been writing things that they like. So they're now saying that the only place that you can get information about the council is on the council's own website. They won't email the press about what the council are up to anymore.
Well, in order to protect the brand, Bristol City Council, they will also tell a lie to say that they're not aware of what's going on in relation to 54 Robinson Road, but yet they can write to Tandam Dabonair and tell her that they're fully aware of what's going on.
It sounds to me like they've got a disaster PR management strategy in place, and they're probably spending more tens of thousands of pounds on that as well, in order to try to win the battle for hearts and minds, which they've already lost, actually. Well, in fact, they're in denial. Anyway, so a fantastic story, Ruth. Where do you think it's heading, this one?
Well, most certainly, if they do not back down on this case, it's heading to the highest court of this land, which is the Supreme Court, which actually protects my characteristic that I have a damaged spinal cord. And they fully well knowing that I have a damaged spinal cord and dragged me down the stairs and treated me worse than an animal could be treated in this country is absolutely atrocious and disgusting. The Bristol City Council, they need to be called out. We're calling them out on it, and everybody needs to be aware that Bristol City Council is right behind this atrocity that's taken place in Bristol. Bristol is not the city to condone this type of behavior or attitudes. We're a city that upholds equality and human rights.
Well, I wonder whether Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees, who I think he still lives in around the Greenbank area, doesn't he? He's not that far from you.
Yeah, I understand. He lives around the corner from me. So he drives past my home on a daily basis. So therefore, he must know that there's a human rights protest that's going on in terms of the eviction against a disabled person, which the Supreme Court of this land has ruled that is a criminal act against a disabled person to actually evict in the case of Ackerman Livingstone.
Well, he doesn't really care about disabled people, quite clearly, because the disabled people are being hit by the charges of £9 a day going into and out of the city centre now as well. I mean, no exemption for the disabled. Of course there should be. There absolutely has to be an exemption for disabled vehicles and for disabled people so that they've got access to the city centre. What he's doing is he's saying that people like that have to go and get the bus instead. But then the bus pays a charge, so of course the bus tickets are going to go up because of this new exemption, this new clean air zone. But anyway, look, we're also joined by Barbara Cook here. Barbara, thanks very much for coming in, because you're doing something about human rights. I hope this case here that we've been talking about with Ruth features in your view of human rights, because what we've got here is something that's happening right on our own doorstep, with almost like a political struggle going on at 54 Robertson Road.
I think it will be represented, yes, next week. Shall I say a little bit about
doing? Tell us who you are. Tell us a bit about your organisation.
Well, I'm Barbara, is my name, and I'm here representing two organisations. The first one started in May 21, which was a peace vigil to break the narrative of all the opposition to the police, courts, crime and sentencing bill being from a violent opposition. A narrative was spun, and to just cut through it, I made a big peace banner and just stood at College Green for 68 Saturdays in a row. So from that, I've had a great chance to talk to the public every week and gauge public attitudes. No idea of what was going on, and then over the 18 months, people have definitely become more aware of what is going on.
So, I mean, I know a little bit about the Police, Crime, Courts and Evidence Bill, and that is that it was specifically targeting gypsies and travellers, and one of the major provisions of it was that if a landowner who sees a gypsy or traveller on their land feels threatened, well, of course, that could mean almost anything, really, like, I just don't want them there, phones the police up, the police can then come and remove them and impound their home and jail them. So this is a big, big change. We've had gypsies and travellers in Britain for, I don't know how long. How long do you think? Maybe about 5,000 years or something like that. And suddenly we're being told, no, these people are no longer allowed to exist. So can you just give us a summary of this bill? Which is now an act of Parliament.
Give you what I would like to say, that bill, over the period of time that we've been protesting, we started out just in opposition to the Police and Crime Bill. That bill alone is 310 pages of legal jargon, and there's many, many things that are not being talked about that are in that one bill alone. Like, there's things about building new detention centres for youth crime, and it looks as though they would be run as academies and private for profit. That's very, very dangerous. There's many issues brought up that aren't being looked at all. There's stuff about impact on sex workers, where they're claiming there's new clauses to protect them, but they're saying it will actually drive sex work underground and make it more dangerous for them. There's, because people have been aware of the police and crime bill, we call it, because people have been aware of that bill threatening travellers and Romani culture, and let's call that out as social cleansing, to attack an ancient culture by saying if more than one of your vehicles is seen together, we will remove the vehicle and we can destroy that vehicle, when they know that is their home. And we're actually in a time when they're trying to criminalise homelessness.
But it's interesting how, I mean, I remember this is back in 2021, I think it was, yeah. I was chatting to a Norfolk police officer about this and saying, do you realise that's in this new bill? And she went, oh my God. So a lot of the police don't want this. In fact, I remember reading from one of the websites of the Gypsies and Travellers that questions sent to all the police forces in the country, and they came back saying, well, actually, the police don't want it either. So what's it all about?
Dare I say? What I'd like to say.
Yes, you do dare say.
We are going, well, United Nations are celebrating this year as the 75th year of international human rights. I find that incredibly ironic that at the very time our country has chosen during COVID to spend their time using their power to rewrite laws in ways which actually take our rights away, at best weaken them, but also take them away. And they want to replace the Human Rights Act with a Bill of Rights, which wasn't wanted. And I've been listening to podcasts that are saying it actually isn't even possible to make it happen within the time frame of 3 years.
Well, for a lot of people, Barbara, this doesn't make sense. What? How can you make sense? Can you make sense of it? What's going on?
I've been joining the dots, and by the end of last year, we also had added on the Nationality and Borders Bill. 2 days before International Human Rights Day last year is when Priti Patel announced that from now on, anyone who tried to rescue a drowning migrant from the Channel would be prosecuted. I was so horrified and upset. We've expanded what we're opposing. There are 7 bills.
Well, she's gone now, isn't she? She's been elbowed out. But I mean, I would love to see that prosecution, because I don't believe that the courts would have any of it.
Well, one of the things that's sort of become apparent over this period of time is, because the laws have been written in very deliberately vague terms, it's going to be at the mercy of how each county's police translate those laws. And then, if the things go to court, it's then at the mercy of how that particular court. And we're seeing the effects of that already. What I'd like to say with next week, I've got to fly my flag that we will be there.
Well, I was going to ask
there.
You about that in a minute. So what effects have we seen so far of this? That's interesting what you were just about to touch on there.
Well, a little while ago, we did a meeting where we asked someone to come from an environmental group, someone from representing travellers and homeless, and someone representing refugees, and I asked them to reflect on, were they feeling any effects at this stage from these laws? Definitely the group that was feeling most threatened and impacted was the refugee groups, and they are really rallying in Bristol to try and protect refugees, but as we know by what's coming out in the news, they're having a really difficult.
But there is this blurring, isn't there, between refugees? There's a blurring between refugees and economic migrants. Some people are coming here to better themselves. Others are coming to flee conflict.
Yes. I can't go into everything here today, but with your question about how are things affecting, I'm watching the news all the time. So say like 2 weeks ago when there was the Just Stop Oil protest, police swooped in, Hertfordshire police swooped in, arrested the journalist.
Yes, we reported that, yeah.
And
an LBC girl.
That was very shocking.
Yeah.
And then luckily it went to court and the court threw it out.
Yeah.
But if we get to a point where they have more of the people they want in the courts, we're under threat of...
Well, thank goodness, I mean, sometimes the courts are there to help things, actually. And it's interesting, the reason the police do that, I think, has got to be, you know, understood. And our own Avon and Somerset police press officer, no exception, is they want to control the narrative. If they see a journalist at the scene, they think is going to be saying something that they don't want to be said. Particularly if the police are behaving or about to behave in a rather brutal manner. They like to scoop the journalists out so that they have to miss their deadlines. They're in the cell maybe even for only 2 or 3 hours, but by the time they come out, they've missed the story and they've missed the deadline. So the police do this in a sort of tactical way. But anyway, I'll ask you, Ruth, about this human rights business. What do you think's going on? We've just heard from Barbara there all sorts of other things which are going on in the background. Now, human rights are being stolen from us.
That's right, and I think you touched on a very salient point there, where the police, the focus is not... The focus on the point about the police is very important because they are the ones who are actually behind the changing of this human rights to the Bill of Rights, because the police realize that a lot of cases that they would bring would often get reversed because of people winning on grounds of the human rights, and they don't want that. So therefore, you know, but a lot of people don't understand from that angle, so that your point is very important.
Okay, Barbara?
I'm going to say I don't think it's from the police. I think the police actually are not coping. I was talking to someone earlier about this today. There's a shortage of police already. It was the Home Secretary, when it was Priti Patel, that ordered the bill, the research to prove her case that we needed the bill. The police, it's been done above their heads. Do you know, in this country, because I've been researching all this stuff, the police are not coping. They don't... I didn't even realise the only mental health support for police is as a charity. There's nothing supporting them. I was talking to somebody earlier who helps look after Broadmead, and she was saying the situation for police support is so dire, they are having to... Broadmead executives who look after Broadmead are now having to pay most of their money up for their own security guard because of the shortage of police.
Well, you know what? So what's happening is the police is slowly being privatised in some of the areas like Broadmead, where they're private security looking after, and Cabot Circus, of course, which is private security. That's in the city centre here in Bristol, big shopping centre. And so the police are stepping away and private security is moving in. But anyway, Martin, I'd like to bring you in on this discussion about human rights. We've seen an enormous amount of erosion, particularly with this Priti Patel bill, and as Barbara's just been saying, an attempt to get rid of the Human Rights Act.
Well, I think you're right that the police in general do not want any of this. It's not them that's been pushing for it. This is political infighting in the Tory party. It's trying to get headlines in the Express and the Mail.
Yeah.
And don't forget that, you know, Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss and all these others wanted to be PM, and to get to be PM they have to have the votes of the Tory membership.
Yes.
That's 80,000 extremely reactionary people, and they want to hear that the asylum seekers are having a hard time. They want to hear that the poor are being punished. They want to hear this is the kind of ridiculously circular conversation going on in these kind of circles. The rest of the society is quite, you know, there's various views, but it's certainly not in this tiny little, you know, I mean, Priti Patel and Suella Braverman are trying to be more extreme than each other. Yeah, they're competing with each other to be hard line on this.
I agree.
And of course, that's why we've ended up with this, because of the political systems. It just doesn't work.
I mean, the people who look supposed to be looking after the police are the Home Office. It's always a good idea, I think, to recognise that the Home Office itself is implicated in child sexual abuse, and they have been running these various abuse inquiries. And yet, there was actually one of the judges, a New Zealand woman, who was looking into the child sex abuse, and she resigned because she was saying, actually, the people who they're appointing to be my staff, I don't want to be my staff, I don't trust them. And so there's an implication of the Home Office in criminality. In fact, there's a new book out by one of the former journalists from The Independent about this level of corruption within the highest levels in the police. And I think, you know, we're in a situation where you've got ordinary police on the ground, the sort of person probably you were chatting to earlier, are having to cope with an attempt to politicise the police from the top down.
Mm.
Tell us a bit about your event that you're doing next weekend anyway, Barbara.
We are doing, I'm not going to call it a protest as such, because again, the big thing behind everything we do, we're trying to link groups, we're trying to be accessible to the public, and I know from the public they feel protested out. They're kind of like, what, another one? What's this one? So our remit, our thing we're proud to do and we're developing is mixing arts and activism, do actions where things can be an enjoyable thing to be at. So we will be having speakers, and groups are having their own stalls. We're trying to represent as many of the human rights as possible, with a chance for people to learn what our rights are, because at this stage we're living in a country where we can very much take those rights for granted and people don't realise just how threatened they are. But we're going to intersperse speakers with poetry and music. It's from 2:30 to 6:30. Dusk is around 4:05, and we will be then lighting 75 candles and putting them around the Sarah Everard tree, I call it. I see it as very symbolic, that tree, as that is where our young people, who are being very picked on with this stuff. You know, this is young people who were staging their first ever protest, the Sarah Everard protesters were sat peacefully on the ground and they were attacked with riot shields. So I want to keep that tree as a very symbolic tree. We're lighting candles there, 75 candles for the 75 years, and there'll be music and interacting with people.
So the 75 years, is that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
Yes.
That's which was pulled together after the Second World War, wasn't it? After seeing all the horrors of the concentration camps and, you know, the various slaughters that were carried out in Nazi-occupied Europe, there was a sort of understanding, right, well, we need to have a bunch of rules, boys and girls, and stick to them now, and we don't want this to happen again.
We were very proud that we helped to create that UK helped to create. And yet now we know, we've had a year this year where, when we had Boris, that, you know, if he broke ministerial code, he'd go, all right, I'll rewrite the ministerial code. And when his third ethics minister in a row said, I won't be able to be an ethics minister, I'll have to resign, he went, all right then, I won't have an ethics minister. And now they're saying, because say like with the refugee cases, they're being the Rwanda flights. I don't understand everything, but I think that the European Court of Human Rights Act is what is really helping when things are put in court. And Boris Johnson, when he was in power, was talking about, okay, then we'll leave the European Court of Human Rights. And that would be so, so shocking. And Dominic Raab created a Bill of Rights that they're trying to rush through, saying, oh, this will be an easier to understand replacement. But in information I've been listening to, they're saying we don't have enough civil servants. You know, Liz Truss sacked loads of them.
Well, and also Jacob Rees-Mogg is trying to sack 90,000 of them at the same time. Anyway, look, sorry, Barbara, can you just explain whereabouts your event's taking place?
So, College Green, on the Green, next Saturday, 2:30 to 6:30, and it will be a nice event to come along to.
So the Sarah Everard tree, is that one of the trees on College Green?
Yes, it is.
Tell us a bit about that, because I was assuming you meant Clapham Common, which is where the attack took place. So we've got our own equivalent.
We've got our own...
Yes. We've got our own tree in Bristol.
Yeah, and it has become quite symbolic because at this time last year, there was also a vigil there for a young Polish woman who died where she couldn't get a legal abortion in her own country, and she died. And there was a very poignant vigil there, and I think it's really good to keep the candlelit vigils in that one place.
And who have you got speaking? What sort of speakers?
We've got Care for Calais, Stand Up to Racism. We've got Justice for Prisoners, who are going to talk about the people who've been put in prison from the Kill the Bill demos. We've got People for the Environment. We've got Bristol for Hong Kong are coming along. They're going to present themselves. Hopefully a good speaker for NHS. Just trying to represent as many of the rights as we can.
Sounds absolutely brilliant. Well done for the effort you're putting into it. It's so important that this sort of stuff does go on, isn't it, Ruth?
I wanted to add that at BASE they have a letter writing club for some of the people who were incarcerated for the Kill the Bill.
At the moment, there's a lot happening in support of the prisoners, but attention has really gone away from the bills, and I'm trying to go, guys, these bills are still happening, and they're adding to them. And, I mean, they spent 2 years putting the Police and Crime Bill through House of Commons, House of Lords. Mm. When the few amendments that were achieved, the Tories took them and made and put them in another bill. They won't even accept the amendments. So it's very dangerous, and we're going to keep flying the flag for let's all learn about what's going on under our noses. Oh, I want to really add something important. Something that I really want... we're going to spend the next year developing a bigger and better event for next year on this, where we can all learn together about our rights and kind of shout out to the government, we know what you're doing. But one of the things that really became apparent over this last year to me was it isn't just that they're weakening our rights. They're writing in things that make themselves unaccountable, and it's very, very dangerous. And what I say to people who don't know what's going on, did you know if you Google journalists going to prison for up to 14 years, that has been passed. This used to be 2 years using the Official Secrets Act. They have passed a clause saying if a journalist humiliates the government, they can go to prison for up to 14 years.
I thought it was people who sign the Official Secrets Act rather than journalists that go to jail. Then you can look at Julian Assange and think, well, he never signed the Official Secrets Act. He's been leaked material from the military. He's actually a journalist.
Yeah, can I just add to this? There's another bill that's already been passed, which gives the police, the military and the intelligence services complete legal immunity.
And the Environment Agency.
There's a whole list
of government agencies, including the Environment Agency.
And it was passed, through Parliament, but because they've got an 80-seat majority on their 43% of the vote at the last election. And, of course, the opposition didn't, apart from the campaign group, the mainstream Labour Party, and I'm a member of the Labour Party, they abstained. So, in other words, this is creeping forward. Why would you want to pass a law to give the intelligence services immunity from prosecution.
Or the Environment Agency.
It's because they're going to carry out... They've been carrying out illegal acts for years, actually, as people who know about these things and listen to the show will know.
Martin, the idea is putting the government above the law. Now, as soon as you start to do that, then you realise you've got to get...
Well, it's an extraordinary thing to pass such a law, in my
view. It's extraordinary.
I mean, people should really wake up. I mean, what sort of a law is that? In a generation, people will realise that was the turning point.
And how can they be allowed to pass that law? Mm. Lawyers study for years and years.
Mm. How so, in a way, it's undermining the whole concept of the law.
Yes.
Because the law has to be equal to everybody.
I mean,
Otherwise, it's absurd.
The police have been placed above the law in this act.
Yeah,
things like the special demonstration squad infiltrating and all the rest of it. There may be prosecutions about that in the end, perhaps, but in the future they'll be able to do that with no fear of prosecution.
Did the chief constables all get together and say that they wanted to be above the law? No.
I think there's resistance from the police.
This is coming down from the top.
Top down.
Yeah.
But also, I wanted to add that it's allowing them to contravene these laws. For example, in my case, I'm not being allowed to have access to my possessions, which is a contravention of the Human Rights Act. And so these laws are being breached all around, and Bristol City Council is getting away with it.
Well, they've boots on the other foot right now, because your house has been reoccupied, Ruth, which is such lovely news. It's nice to have a little beacon of hope, isn't it, when you have injustice bailiffs and people like this and the police enforcing injustice, then to see something happen. Anyway, look, Barbara, just for anyone that's interested in coming along, you've told us where and when it is, but how do we follow your group online or elsewhere?
Thanks. We're on Instagram. That's where we mainly are. We are on Facebook as well, but I'm a bit lax on there. But we are very active on Instagram as Bristol Outcry and Bristol Peace Vigil. And we have public meetings on the first Wednesday of the month at People's Republic of Stokes Croft.
Not a million miles away from here, eh?
No. And also, if people are interested, next Wednesday from 2 till 6... we're going to have a community making placards and banners for the Saturday Free happening here at People's Republic of Stokes Croft downstairs, where there's a really, really wonderful art exhibition on as well.
Sounds great. Brillo. Fantastic. Anyway, last word from you, Ruth. Whereabouts, do you have any sort of legal challenge going on? Do you have a solicitor, that sort of thing?
Yes, actually, I received in the post today, which is very good, from Citizen Advice lawyers. They're going to challenge the aspect of the direct discrimination under the Equality Act and the Human Rights Act on that part of the case, because I've had to split up my case into several different segments. I'm going to have a lawyer to deal with the housing part and another lawyer to deal with the fact that the police have actually stood by and watched me be tortured and did nothing about it. Refer themselves to the IPCC.
Well, we're going to have to keep a very close eye on all that.
Yes.
And isn't it amazing that they're extorting, isn't it bizarre? They're extorting council tax from you, even though you don't really owe it because you're entitled to the council tax relief. And they're using that money to then pay bailiffs and lawyers to evict you from your own house. It's perverse. This is not what councils, Martin.
They've probably spent more money on the enforcement of this ridiculous order than they would have collected from you in the first place.
That's right.
And that's the that's the stupidity of council tax, which, as I said earlier, is poll tax marks too.
Which I said is the misappropriation of taxpayers' money.
I think we're getting to the stage where people are simply not going to... I mean, a bit like this clean air zone. People are now saying... I mean, for example, in Birmingham, we've had half the people going in and out of Birmingham have simply just not paid the tax. Now, whether they have to pay that in the long run is another question. But, the idea of just civil disobedience, we're saying, well, this is an unfair tax. We're not paying it. We may see the same with council tax into the future. So, and that's probably the reason, I think, why the council has said, well, we're not going to be... we're going to have council tax relief for anybody that's on benefits, and as soon as they switch that off, they're going to have all sorts of trouble. They're going to be spending more on trying to get the money from people who don't actually have any money at all. I mean, you could spend an infinite amount of money trying to get money from someone that doesn't have any money, couldn't you?
Anyway. But you know that during this time, they're making it harder for people who don't have money to be able to take something to court.
Sounds like a kind of class war there, really.
I do feel...
You think?
The equality things. And the electoral system is a terrible... There's an electoral bill where they're saying now you've got to have certain identity. But the civil service side of that is saying we can't get that ready in time for the next election.
Do you want to say something about that, Martin? Because it's a bad idea,
isn't
it?
What may happen? Well, it's a bad idea. It's been taken lock, stock and barrel from the United States. And if you think about the original poll tax, the idea was that poor people won't register to vote because they won't want to pay the tax. And of course, in the US, if you've got any kind of criminal conviction in many states, you cannot vote ever again. So you get arrested once for dope or weed by the cops, and then you lose your right to vote.
Well, I don't think that's right.
Of course it's not right, but that's what they do. And
so
of course,
anyway,
the police go around arresting as many people as possible so they can put them all off the electoral register.
All this makes what Barbara's doing next Saturday the more important. Make sure you're down there, everybody.
Thank you.
So thanks very much to Ruth Nestor and Barbara Cook from Bristol Outcry. We're going to now hear a bit about education. This is home education, actually, which has gone up by a third. That's how much the education system has collapsed via COVID.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. The pandemic has played havoc with school attendance, and the Children's Commissioner says that almost 115,000 children are now being home educated, a 34% higher than before the pandemic, with little, if any, monitoring of their educational welfare. Even worse, 9 in 10 local authorities believe they have not been able to identify home-educated children. So when will my right honourable friend be bringing forward the register of homeschooled children so they're identified and we can be sure that their needs are looked after and they're not falling through the net?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we support the right of parents to home-educate their children, and we know many do well. But however, this is not the case for all, and that's why local authorities must seek to identify those children missing education. We've published guidance on the arrangements they should be following, and indeed make sure that they have oversight of elective home education.
What's happening there is, as you know, there is a right to home education in this country, but you have to demonstrate that you are actually educating at home and reaching some standards. Because obviously kids not coming to school is not because their parents are home educating them. It's because they're not educating them at all, or they're educating them not to participate in society. So there's got to be some oversight of this. In general, the principle is that all children should go to school, although there are exceptions made to that. And, it's about child protection, really.
But is it also that families have just felt that the education that the kids are getting during COVID was so awful that this is almost a sort of hangover from the chaos that COVID caused in schools?
Well, it did. And a lot of kids who were the sort of marginal kids anyway didn't go to school for quite a long time. And it's quite clear, and some families didn't have access to computers, for example.
Sometimes parents are quite chaotic themselves, aren't they?
Well,
never mind the kids.
That's right. So, in other words, those kids, most at risk, I mean, the most at risk kids did go into school throughout COVID. So, at one stage, I was working with those kids, yeah? Because we were still going into school for those kids. But there's another cohort which are not quite as at risk as that first cohort, but they didn't come to school and they started to, they've not come back. Yeah. And these kids are not being educated at home by middle class parents. They're basically, they've just got into the habit of not coming into school, which is one of the things that the lockdowns and COVID and all the rest has led to. And there's all sorts of knock-on effects of all of this.
Okay, well, I'm hoping that I'm joined on the line from the US by Don DeBar. Are you there, Don? Can you hear me?
Yes, I am, and I hear you 4x4.
Fantastic, Don. It's lovely. So live from the US, Don. Don, can you just introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about your background, please.
It's very shady. No, I'm... I'm a 68-year-old widower,
retired from a long career in the title insurance business, which is real estate and finance and law, basically, the law of ownership and insurance of property rights, real estate rights. I've been a journalist for the last 25, 30 years. It began as an avocation. It's what I do now, and political commentary. I am presently doing regular radio reporting for KPFK-FM in Los Angeles, which is Pacifica Radio's Los Angeles flagship. And I do frequent commentary on Press TV, RT, and other international media. In fact, I'm going to bail out of this in about 20 minutes to do a piece on Press TV.
So if anyone really likes what Don's got to say, you can skip off this program and you can watch him live on Press TV, if you can manage to figure out how to, since Press TV is pretty much banned right across the Western world. But anyway, Don, I'd just like to hear from you your thoughts on, I mean, anything you really want to talk about politics. But I think the biggest thing I've seen in the States this week is the further attempts to stop Donald Trump running for president. I mean, obviously, in a democracy, you do want to have all of the best candidates, and some people think that Trump is one of them standing, and it looks as if there's pretty severe attempts to stop Trump doing that.
It's been constant. People need to have a little background on Trump. By the way, I'm not for or against Donald Trump. I don't think he's the savior of the world, and I also don't think he's the great Satan. I think his significance actually has very little to do with him and more to do with the phenomenon that lifted him up, that also was manifest in 2016 by the lifting up of Sanders in the Democratic Party primary, although he got whatever that happened, and the people that were in the street over Black Lives Matter and other things, going back even to 2011 with the Occupy Wall Street. The working class in the United States, like the working class in Europe, and I assume in Australia and New Zealand and, you know, across much of the Western world, quote unquote, even you in the East, you know, have been suffering 40 years plus of austerity and worse, and a really long history of exploitation going back almost to the formation as a class. And although they have had various mechanisms for blowing air into the system as it's had its recurring collapses, it was identified 150 years ago by economists and political scientists as an integral phenomenon of this type of economic system, it's reached a point where it's almost, well, there was a class war, they won, it's over, now what? And the people are getting very restless as they see a very bleak future in front of them. So Trump ran as an outsider, and he had a particular media cachet coming into this, which is why he was even a candidate, although he had not been in politics before. He, for some reason, or by some series of coincidences over his adult life, he became a darling of the U.S. media, of Hollywood, and of Madison Avenue. And so, on the one hand, he was a symbol of the brash entrepreneur billionaire class. And so if you had a Michael J. Fox movie, for example, where Michael J. Fox is a concierge with cachet in a hotel, well, while he's working in the lobby of the hotel, Donald Trump and his entourage walk through. And there you go. That's how the rich live, etc. He had this kind of media presence across the media, from news to radio to the Hollywood movies and such. And then he runs for president. And he had been politically active some, buying advertising space, you know, buying newspapers to publish his own editorials. And some of them were pretty harsh. In particular, one that was published in New York back in the 80s in a case called the Central Park Five, where he called for the restoration of the death penalty. For that case, it turned out that the people that he was vilifying as part of a massive media campaign by all the media here, by the way, including the New York Times and the people who now criticize him for this. He was wrong. They were innocent. They went to prison. They were railroaded into prison for, I forget, 10, 15 years or something, but they were innocent. He had expressed his opinion on other things, including, notably, opposition to the Iraq War. And in any event, he decides to run for president, and he was encouraged, his candidacy was encouraged by the Clintons, as we learned from WikiLeaks, because they were hoping that he would be the easiest one to beat out of the other professional politicians. And what happened was he started shooting up in the polls, and they were covering it. Now, the U.S. corporate media here, it basically runs as a loss leader in the large corporate, you know, environment. They are owned basically so that power can speak directly to us, and the space where people might speak to each other is taken up by them. They own it. They use it for the purposes of telling us what to do and not allowing us to speak back.
Can I just butt in a second there? Because, Don, I mean, one of the things that seems to me exemplifies that is the fact that, you know, years ago, for example, on things like public transportation, that people get a chance to chit-chat with each other. They can talk about anything. Sometimes they talk about politics. Nowadays, there's been a big attempt to sort of force people away from public transport into their own private cars, where they're just getting what they're doing is they're getting people like you on Pacifica Radio. They're getting, well, maybe not so many like you, but they're getting a kind of broadcast narrative which is nothing like as good quality as what you'll get from people straight face to face.
That's correct. Not only that, you'll notice going into public transportation now the phenomenon of people looking at their little box as opposed to talking to each other. So this is multidimensional, this phenomenon. So I'll try to wrap this up quicker. So the long story short, he shoots up in the polls. The media, who make their basically their money to sustain their operation every fourth year here during presidential elections, because their viewership shoots way up, which means that because people are watching the election, they turn it into like a sporting event, like a football series or something. And as the ratings shoot up, the advertising dollar cost per minute shoots way up. And this is every fourth year they make their money. They run at a loss the rest of the time. Trump running had it off the charts. They were, wow, this is the greatest phenomenon possible. And they covered him extensively because of that. Well, sometime in late 2015, he spoke a couple of great heresies. NATO may be obsolete. We shouldn't be doing these wars that we're doing. We shouldn't be doing regime change. We shouldn't be doing nation building. And like they did to Howard
Dean. That's like heresy.
Fundamental heresy in the war state here. And so what they did was they tried to turn off his mic like they did with Howard Dean and they've done with others over the years. Except when they did that, people flicked the remote and put on HBO or whatever, and they stopped watching the news, and the ratings plummeted. And they said, oh, well, we have to cover him. We're just going to do a 24/7, carpet bombing attack on him. And they did that. The ratings went back up, and they've been doing it since. So the latest things that, for example, I'm on one of my computers here that has Microsoft stuff across the board. My browser is the Microsoft one. And so when I turn it on, it has all this news, quote unquote, from Microsoft. Well, Microsoft's one of the co-owners of MSNBC, for example. Every day now, for the last week that I've been using this computer, the very first, second, and third story that they put up there has something to do with Trump being embarrassed, indicted, accused. Here, bench slap. Legal experts say court eviscerated Trump judge for interfering in Mar-a-Lago case. That's the top one at the moment. And so this has been going on for as long as, ever since he spoke the great heresies. Something that's interesting about it is that his support has only changed slightly over the last four years.
It's got to be the next question, isn't it? Does this propaganda work?
Well, what it's done is, number one, harden his support. and number two, increased it somewhat. Not a lot. The U.S. electorate, like the populations in much of the Western world and colonies, is about 51 to 49% divided on just about every issue there is. And the more insignificant the issue, the more intensive is the hostility between them. This is a phenomenon that Freud studied, by the way. I can't remember the terminology for it, but it's basically that the insanity or the whatever of the pathology of the slight differences or small differences. People that have great differences in culture, language, or whatever, their interactions are conducted in one way. People that have everything similar except for one minor difference, they're conducted in another way, and that minor difference, it looks larger to them than everything. It's like a fish in water. If you ask a fish what is water, a fish has no idea what water is, because a fish is in water all the time. That's just the universe. So these things here, abortion rights, gay marriage, interracial marriage, for some reason this is suddenly an issue. No one in this country has thought about that outside of what Madison Avenue or some think tank for 50 years.
Well, maybe these think tanks, they do get paid a lot of money, don't they, to weigh in with these issues to try and, I think Martin and Brian Eno, you picked up on this thing from Brian Eno, Martin, proper gender, the idea that you can try and steer the narrative, not necessarily saying what people should think, but giving people the various, sending people down rabbit holes that are inconsequential, and I suppose filling their minds up with goo, Don.
Yes. Goo, brown mushy goo, okay?
So anyway, yeah, this week what we've had is Trump's tax returns being exposed. I mean, there seems to have been various attempts to for the judicial cosh on Trump, but he's managed to wriggle free like Houdini. And yeah. Do you think this, they're going to bring him down with his tax returns?
Well, no. One of the things that gets me, I mean, this has been a battle now since he was candidate back in 2015, his tax returns. And as a matter of fact, the attorney general here for the state of New York, where I live, her entire raison is when she ran as attorney general, her program was, I'm going to get Donald Trump's tax returns. Now, whatever they are, all of these people that want his tax returns have had control of the IRS. And we know from the memos and the FBI and all these other places how that all operates. And you know that every person that's talking about Trump's tax return in public has seen it with IRS agents explaining things to them to their heart's content. So this thing is it's a show for us. But the thing that gets me is the people conducting this, if this were all legitimate, the reason they would want to see Trump's tax returns is to find out, how the hell did he do all that stuff and stay out of jail? I want to hire his accountant.
Most possibly. Anyway, well, look, what about, let's have a jump to the NATO conference this week, because yeah. I think in a way this is one of the most important organizations in the Western world. I've studied for a long time the political lobby wing of NATO, which is the Bilderberg conferences, and NATO is picking a fight with Russia. It seems to be led by Britain and the United States, but actually the people on the front line are not Britain and the United States. They are countries like Sweden, Finland, and Germany, and the Baltic countries, and Poland, places like that, seem to be actually on the front line of this struggle. So let's just jump to earlier this week, the NATO conference in Romania, and hear from Secretary General Jan Stoltenberg. We've got a few clips, and I'd just like to get our guests' thoughts after each one.
Romania is a committed and a highly valued NATO ally. And we meet when war is raging on in Ukraine, a neighbor to Romania. So the foreign ministerial meeting will be a very timely and important meeting. What we have seen since President Putin's brutal invasion of Ukraine is that President Putin is failing in Ukraine. He is responding with more brutality, attacking gas infrastructure, power lines, and trying to deprive the Ukrainians of water, electricity, light, and heating. Therefore, we need to support Ukraine, because what we see is that President Putin is trying to use winter as a weapon of war, which is inflicting a lot of suffering on the Ukrainian people. NATO allies are providing unprecedented support to Ukraine, and they will continue to provide unprecedented support to Ukraine, including by helping them to rebuild their gas and power infrastructure, and of course also continue to deliver air defence systems.
Well, I think I sent you this week, Tony, a transcript of what Jamie Shea, who was NATO's spokesperson, said during the 78-day bombing campaign in Yugoslavia, in Serbia, which attacked all of the electricity infrastructure. And he said, people may say that this is an attack on the civilian population, but that electricity infrastructure also underpins the Serbian military, and therefore we feel it's justified for NATO airstrikes to hit bridges, railway stations, all the infrastructure of Serbia, in order to force them to accept the independence of Kosovo. And that was NATO's argument back in 98, whenever it was. But of course, when the Russians do the same thing in the Ukraine, it's bad, bad, bad. And of course, in the Middle East, the US has blatantly wiped out whole cities like Fallujah and Raqqa, killing thousands and thousands of civilians in order to try and crush what they regarded as their political opponents.
Well, it's called regime change. That's what they're trying to do. Anyway, Don, what do you make of this idea of using winter as a weapon, as Putin's now doing?
I think first of all, the strategists in Moscow, wherever the thinking is based at the moment, is to give Ukraine exactly what it's been seeking all this time, and that is a common future with the rest of Europe, and because the rest of Europe is going to be going without electricity and heat and light for much of the coming winter. And why should the Ukrainians, who are getting basically at the crux of the cause of this thing, the leadership in Ukraine, so-called, why shouldn't the people in Ukraine share that same fate? I think that's part of what's going on here. Europe is going to be dark from like Madrid, to Donbass, basically. So there's that aspect to it. The other point, and it's absolutely true that the U.S. is the worst offender, on orders of magnitude in the world on all of these things. Fallujah alone, and Israel, of course, Gaza. I mean, that these people can even utter this nonsense is amazing. But the idea of using winter as a weapon borders on the metaphysical. I have images of a small group of people they used to monitor who was on the wall in the Kremlin, like, and do tea leaf reading, about who was in power and who's not by where they were sitting. I have an image of those old, dark old men that used to be huddled up on top of the wall, now sitting in some room in a circle, around a pentagram, conjuring up snow. We're going to weaponize winter against Kiev. Bam! And shaking one of those little devices, with the snowman and the sleigh and the little snowflakes that dance around. It's so absurd that I can't really address it.
But hang on, it's not that absurd, is it? I mean, the timing is quite important here. The knocking out the power infrastructure in Ukraine just as winter starts kicking in.
The winter is there every year. You can look it up on the calendar. It's what is being done and what response is that inducing.
Okay, well,
that isn't weaponizing the winter. That's turning off your lights, and hey, if it gets cold, you should have thought of it before.
Yeah, well, maybe we should be thinking about that too here. Very interesting what you're saying about power going off. I mean, you know, I suppose that's the ultimate solidarity with Ukraine, isn't it? We'd probably be in the middle of one of these broadcasts and the power would just go off and we need to get ourselves a decent generator. Right, so a bit more from Jens Stoltenberg in Romania this week.
We will meet with the foreign minister of Ukraine, Kuleba, tonight. We will also meet tomorrow with the foreign ministers of our close partners Georgia, Moldova and Bosnia and Herzegovina, expressing our support to them. And then we will also address our resilience of our critical infrastructure and the challenges that China is posing to our security, to our values and to our economy. So this will be a very substantive foreign ministerial meeting, and once again, many thanks to Romania for hosting all of us here. It is in this magnificent place.
I find myself, my eyebrows flicking up when he mentioned we're going to get Georgia and Bosnia-Herzegovina
Moldova
to discuss what we're going to do about China. It's like, wow, that one, where did that come from? Amazing. I'm sure the Bosnia-Herzegovinans will be a really, really good ally to take on the Chinese, won't they? But of course, during the bombing of Serbia back in the 90s, they did in fact bomb the Chinese embassy. Yes, and they said, we've got all this smart munitions, which can knock out all of the electricity infrastructure, but we accidentally bombed the Chinese embassy. We didn't accidentally bomb the Belgrade national TV station. That was deliberate. We killed their weather girls because it was a nest of lies. Yeah, and of course, if the Russians were to hit the Kiev national TV, because of course in Kiev all the TV and media now have been centralised in the hands of the government, and lots of political parties, pro-Russian political parties, have all been banned. It's martial law.
Yeah, in fact, they had the thugs turned up at one of the opposition TV stations just after the 2014 coup.
I mean, the whole way in which this has been presented in the West is extraordinary. What's happened in Ukraine, I was an aid worker in Yugoslavia in the 90s, and it's a very similar situation. We've had a thing today about how Zelensky's wife, you know, that wonderful woman, was going on about, even though they've got no electricity in Kiev, they're going to have Christmas trees anyway, just to show that they're not going to be defeated, because they're not going to let the Russians get rid of Christmas. And you feel like shouting from the rooftops. That's because the Russian Orthodox people who voted to leave the Ukraine don't celebrate Christmas on the 25th of December anyway. They have a different Christmas day, and that's how ethnically different these two groups are. Very similar to the difference between the Croatian Catholics and the Serbian Orthodox in Yugoslavia. And so the Ukraine conflict, to my mind, is very similar to what happened in Yugoslavia, but the roles are reversed. The Russians are intervening to protect their protégés, whereas in Yugoslavia, NATO intervened to protect their protégés, demanding independence for Kosovo, for example.
Okay, Don, what do you make of this whole idea of, well, I mean, anything that Stoltenberg was saying, and including this idea of, getting everyone together to defeat China?
Well, some of the same grouping, by the way, met in Kiev yesterday under this Kiev Security Forum, All for Victory. And China is public enemy number 1.5 among that group, and it's the same players. Along with the U.S. being overtly there. And the game plan being assembled there is break Russia up into constituent national parts. The Russian Empire is a series of conquests that needs to be undone. And that is a per se case of threatening the state of Russian Federation, which is one of the two legs that President Putin and Lavrov and everyone else who stated Russia's nuclear doctrine said it's one of the two cases in which we will use nuclear weapons. One, if you use them against us. Two, if the survival of our state is at stake. And they are now openly talking about taking it apart and then going to China.
Incredible. Anyway, how do people follow your work? Because you're going to have to skip off onto a real big network now, aren't you? Well, even if it is banned in the West.
They're all real big. This is a great program, and I'm glad to be here. I'm Don DeBar on Facebook. I get out of Facebook jail tomorrow. I got out of the Twitter jail the day before yesterday. I'm Don DeBar at Twitter. It's DONDEBAR. And I'm on VK.com also and a variety of other places.
Yeah, VK, I think, is very important if anyone because it does a similar job to Facebook. Only thing is, there's none of this Zuckerberg nonsense. Anyway, Don DeBar, thanks ever so much for joining us. And what are you talking about on Press TV in a minute?
I'm not sure. I'm going to find out. I forgot already. This is my third interview.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, good luck. I'm sure you'll be tremendous. Anyway, thanks ever so much. And we're going to hear the last clip from Stoltenberg. We'll get Martin's comment on that.
NATO allies and NATO has already delivered critical supplies to Ukraine to help them mitigate the consequences of the brutal attacks against critical infrastructure, including gas and power infrastructure. We have delivered generators, we have delivered spare parts, and allies are in different ways helping to rebuild the destroyed infrastructure. We need to realize that there are enormous effects of the attacks. The Ukrainians are able to shoot down many of the incoming missiles and drones, but not all of them, and therefore these attacks has caused significant damage. I think we all have seen these pictures taken from satellites where you see Europe in light and then you see Ukraine dark, and that reflects the enormous consequences. So there's a huge task to rebuild all of this. One of the important reasons why this meeting today is so important and timely is that this provides us with the platform to mobilize further support, to step up even more, and also for Minister Kuleba to meet all his colleagues in NATO and then to address those urgent needs. And I'm confident that the Minister Kuleba will raise also the need for stepping up further when it comes to rebuilding their power infrastructure.
So that's Jens Stoltenberg, Secretary General of NATO, speaking. I wonder if Boris seemed to at one point be saying he might want to pursue that job, but now he's said that he will be. Is he standing or stepping down at the next election?
He's going to stand in his constituency.
He is.
He's going to
so
stand
he probably
as
won't
a
be trying to get become Secretary General of NATO.
He might get voted out, of course.
That's NATO's point of view there. Jen is talking about, Martin.
Well, if you think about it, the Russians could at any stage have knocked out the electricity infrastructure of the Ukraine. They didn't, because the original strategy was to try and drive the Ukrainians to the negotiating table. And it was successful, because the Ukrainians have been refusing to negotiate for 8 years, since 2015. And then, as soon as this latest round of fighting began, and of course it all began in 2014, this isn't just happening. Same as in Yugoslavia, there's a stage of processes for things breaking down. You know, it doesn't all happen all at once. They basically did have a deal on the table, which had been brokered by Erdogan in Turkey. And then Boris Johnson went in April this year to Kiev and told Zelensky, we can see that you're doing some kind of deal with the Russians, but don't, because we won't accept it, whatever you do. So you've got to fight on to the end, and we will support you. And Zelensky at that point, because he was under threat from the right wing anyway, who'd threatened to kill him if he did any deals with the Russians, so he's now made a virtue of necessity and decided he's going to be, you know, the Che Guevara of Ukraine, fighting Russian imperialism, blah, 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 blah.
Okay.
With his carefully cultivated beard, etc.
In one of the best points Don made there, before he had to go and jump onto Press TV, was about this whole idea of the generators, you know, the power here.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, anyone got a spare generator? We could probably do with one here, because over the winter we're being told anyway that there may not be enough generating capacity here in the UK.
Well, there's a big crunch coming up, which is that the European Union and NATO countries have agreed that they're only going to buy Russian energy at an agreed, you know, a price that they will set, like a sort of buyer's cartel. Now, if they do that, the Russians will stop supplying energy to them. Now, this will then feed into the spot markets for energy, because, of course, it's all dealt with by futures.
The casino.
So then the price will go through the roof, and that means poorer countries in the EU will have power cuts. I can see the same sort of thing happening here. Well, I'm old enough to remember the three-day week in the 1970s.
But how does this fit with electric cars?
Well, it doesn't, does it? I mean, the whole thing, all of this stuff, there's the real world of a potential nuclear war and economic collapse, and then there's all sorts of fantasy stuff about how we're all going to have electric cars and there's going to be a cleaner, greener planet once we've smashed Russia and China.
There certainly is. Anyway, we're also joined by Judith Brown. Hi, Judith. Thank you for popping up on the bus.
Yeah.
I know you've been working quite closely with Piers Robinson. Do you want to just say a little bit about Piers? Because he's, I think, very important character, very influential, but now cancelled.
Yeah, he has. He was, it's not recent that he's been cancelled. He was a professor, I think, of communications at Sheffield, and I think that he specialised in propaganda studies. And in looking at the propaganda studies, he found that the gas attacks in Syria were actually all propaganda. And when he found that out, I think, from what I gather, he became unemployed, and now he operates. He's moved to Germany, and he's which is where his wife comes from, and he's running a centre for propaganda studies.
Because we've been talking about propaganda there a lot, and Don particularly explained a lot about the propaganda around Trump, the propaganda around NATO. Yeah. You know, you've got a deep state in the US that's got to be behind NATO.
Yeah.
So what have you been doing around propaganda?
Yeah. Well. We formed a media unit first of all at Heart, which I am a member of, but not a very active member now. But at the time, I was more active, and we formed a media group. And I actually asked Piers if he wanted to join it, and we did some research initially. My research was looking at the new Ministry of Truth organised by the BBC, the BBC Truth Initiative, and also looking at the way that newspaper and broadcast regulation had operated during the early COVID times. And then we moved to Panda, which in a sense is more appropriate because Panda is a South African group, very active, and it's more multidisciplinary. Its Heart was more health orientated, but we've moved to Panda now. And we're, as part of that group, we're continuing doing various studies. A couple of months ago, I did a study on online harms legislation to find out how many countries were thinking of passing online harms legislation, only to find that a huge number already had. And we were sort of in a catch-up situation, although we were led to believe that we were going to be the sort of first in the world with this sort of legislation.
Well, it took ages, didn't it? It's just been the announcement this week. Well, they changed the name of it. It's now called the Online Safety Bill.
Yeah.
And it's taken years to to come to actually being voted on.
I think the first legislation, as far as I know, was in Germany in 2018, and that followed by a huge swathe of similar bills in many countries.
Well, you've sent a little shiver down my spine, and that doesn't happen very often, because I remember we reported in Germany the introduction of these compulsory vaccine bills for the first time.
Yeah.
And it almost seems as if this legislation is being drawn up and cooked up.
Yeah.
Before the events that need it will
and
take place.
It's funny, whether you look at regimes like, for example, Egypt, or whether you look at Germany or any other countries, it seems as if the pattern is very similar, in as much as they're all saying that they're going to protect vulnerable people, especially children. So there seems to be a pattern where they're saying we're going to protect vulnerable people. But in terms of that that part of the legislation, it actually only reiterates legislation that's already passed, but then they're bringing in a new parts of the legislation, which is for disinformation, misinformation, which is saying that it's going to counter that. Of course, what they're really saying is, I mean, in effect, since 2020, what we've found is that there's been a censorship of any views that don't coincide with the official narrative. I mean, I'm not even going to call it a government narrative because it's much wider than that, as I'm sure you know, but also a censorship of views that that don't coincide with that same narrative. And some of those views that have been censored are obviously really high-profile people, really high-profile scientists, really high-profile doctors. And, of course, what...
Politicians.
Some high-profile politicians, but not so many. And also, of course, some high-profile people like Lord... Sutcliffe, is it the ex judge? What's his name, Lord?
Sumption.
Sumption. Yeah, that's it. I mean, you know, so you've got some really high powered people that are opposing it, and people like Vera Sharpov, who was a Holocaust survivor and has done lots of research, and is in a, but, although she must, I mean, be in her 90s,
I'd like
she's
to
very
just
eloquent.
Look at the context of this, because I mean, you could see the whole COVID agenda, whether you're looking at the failure to treat people for COVID with these cheap treatments like ivermectin, chloroquine. Even the common cold, I was reading again this week, the common cold kicks out COVID. Why weren't we being given the common cold? These things. Then we've also got the whole narrative around the Ukrainian Nazis that we are supporting with our taxpayers' money, who really are Nazis. They're not neo-Nazis. They are supporters of Adolf Hitler, of Stefan Bandera, who were actually Nazis. They share the same ideology. So this is another thing. So we look at COVID, Ukraine, and what about the climate? I mean,
There's the global warming. I mean,
the whole climate business. And, all I'm saying is, it's really informing and deciding much of our energy policy, which, as we were just talking about, well, we may be having no energy periods of time over the winter.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying here, I suppose, is these battles have taken place in the mainstream press. A lot of people are catching up. Some journalists are catching up. Some publications are catching up. And so there seems to be this attempt, particularly online, to stifle the counter-arguments.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, another issue which you haven't mentioned is the gender issue, which in many ways very much mimics the COVID issue, in as much as it involves pharmaceutical companies, where it's sort of become, if you actually support women's rights as against transgender rights, you're seen as being bigoted or hate speech. These sorts of things which should... I'm not saying that there shouldn't be alternative views on these issues. I think that there should. But I think that what should happen is that the media should allow both debates to be ongoing.
Well,
science is never I think what was Boris Johnson's words, he was saying that science was it's settled. There's no such thing as settled science, and just to say that is very unscientific, because science is where one person gives one point of view, another person opposes it, and then there is a battle of ideas, and that's always been true with science. But I've now moved on to something. I've sort of completed the work on the online harms legislation, and I think it's quite interesting, the British legislation, which is very complicated, and bits have been taken out.
Well, we have
out.
Had good news on that this week, haven't we? They're taking out this whole concept of the clauses around this whole idea of legal but harmful.
Yeah, exactly, and I think that was going to be very difficult to implement anyway, but in effect, that in the mainstream media, they've already done that. But I've been looking at the fact-checking organisations. It started off as quite a small thing, but it's ended up sort of really enormous, because I think there may be thousands of fact-checking organisations in the world now. So all the time, like every day, I keep finding, you know, a website with another 50 on or something. And looking through them, there's there's definitely a pattern. You have to look at international groups, not just British groups or European groups or English-speaking groups, because what you find is that a lot of countries have actually got contracts with Facebook. It's called the third-party fact-checkers policy. Mm. And lots of masses of them in India have got these contracts, and also all over Europe, especially in poorer countries, have got these contracts with Facebook. And so obvious, it's, most of them don't say how much money that they're getting in a month. But for example, there is one Facebook fact checker. I think it's from Greece, and I think it's called Alinksa Hoaxes. That on its website, you were able to see that it was getting nearly $500,000 US dollars from Facebook.
Well, maybe this is one of the reasons Facebook are going under economically. Yeah. You know, they're in the black, aren't they? In the red, actually.
Yeah. Well, in fact, if you look at it, I mean, there's masses. I mean, you know, when you look at it, not all, but I would say that 8 out of 10 of the groups that you look at say that they're in the Facebook third party fact checkers group.
And well, would it be nice if Martin and I and you could get paid whatever it is, however many, $500,000 to do a bit of fact checking?
Yes,
I think we might find the facts get slightly differently checked.
Yes, and it was quite interesting because I went to one fact checker group and it said that if you proceed to this group, you're likely to have a virus or something. But anyway, I did proceed to it. It looked like a very normal sort of like group, but it didn't say that it was doing the right sort of fact checking. And so therefore, if fact checking groups are fact checking and not following the agenda, I think that they are managing to close those down by Facebook and all other sorts of organizations, different web browsers, saying that they're dangerous groups to go to. But all the time I keep finding more. I think I've got to draw a line in the sand somewhere, because it's just getting to the point where every day the workload gets actually bigger. And I think when you've got to a certain number, like, you know, 300 or something, you've got to
say, how many have you found?
Well, I think the ones that I've found are probably in the region of 400 or 500, but the ones that I've sort of like got on my list to check at the moment, I think that I've got to get to a point, because what you have to do is look at all the websites. You can translate nearly all of them on the web, and then you can look through, you can find out how they started. A lot, like, I think that someone was talking about Moldova on the previous item. Now, Moldova has got a fact-checking group. I don't think it's got a contract with Facebook, but it's the people that fund it are people like USAID, the US embassy in Moldova, and so on. So on the website it said, we give generous thanks to the people to the American people for allowing us fact-checking. So you can see that where they aren't funded by Facebook, maybe the British embassy funds them, or the American embassy.
Okay, so the obvious question's got to be, how rigorous is the checking of the fact checkers? Who checks the fact checkers to make sure that they're not actually just simply a PR lobby?
It may be that I'm the first one, Tony.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, I suppose there's none of the universities are properly looking at this anymore.
No, not indeed.
Martin, this is interesting, isn't it? Yeah. The idea that, you know, as Facebook and these sorts of social media operations start to grow in popularity because people are disillusioned with the mainstream media, they much rather share news with their friends that they trust, and they, in a way, they are the editors as they share information, that we've got this whole world of fact-checking building up around social media to say, no, that's wrong. It doesn't necessarily, well, it might actually put someone like Don DeBar, put them in Facebook jail, and say you're in jail for a few weeks and you're not allowed to say anything if they've checked your fact, and then found it to be wanting. So this is, it's almost like the, as people have flocked to social media, so there's been an attempt to lock that down.
Yeah, and also they've used it more offensively. So social media is used in color revolution strategies to overturn regimes you don't like. So, you know, they play both ends of it. They're trying to control their own populations by controlling what they can see and hear. So a few years ago now, and things like the World Socialist website, they just downgraded their rating on Google, and they lost, you know, a massive amount of their potential audience. Which is, of course, the audience which pays for their website. So it's a way of shutting them up. And then, of course, small groups in enemy countries are given quite large amounts of money to seed social media propaganda. I mean, in Syria, you know, the MI6 were paying for all of these so-called citizen journalists to tell the story of what was going on. So we then get presented with the White Helmets in Syria as a genuinely local group that's sprung up spontaneously, and we're just bringing you what they're saying without pointing out that we set them up and gave them all of the media
and
all the media training so that they could then rush around, you know, rescuing babies from burning buildings, which of course anybody who looked at the video said, well, that's not real civil defense work, it's just theater, a lot of it.
Now,
it's very dangerous theater because of course they don't just do that, they also carry out terrorist actions like chemical weapons attacks, like the massacre in the Maidan Square in 2014, which a court case in Kiev in 2018 proved was carried out by people from Georgia who'd been flown in for the purpose of shooting down demonstrators and police officers. This is all very, very advanced psychological warfare stuff.
Well, I'd like to just focus down on the whole energy question for a few minutes, and just pointing out, as you've just done, we've heard that threats that there may not be any electricity through the winter here in the UK. We have no idea whether that will transpire or not, but assuming that it does, that's not very good for the users of electric cars. Those people who've bought electric cars might be thinking, well, actually, I'm going to actually borrow my friend's diesel car if I'm going to make a journey where I might not be able to charge my car.
Might be no diesel either.
Well, all right. good question. Well, I don't know if that. Yes, actually, I was at a petrol station the other day with the big sign saying no diesel. But I mean, that happened, didn't it? Actually, last year, autumn last year, the fuel companies themselves decided that they weren't going to send fuel to the petrol stations. It was all blamed on Brexit by people like you, Martin. But I disagreed. I thought, well, actually, there would be plenty of drivers around who could actually do those journeys, and that they were doing that deliberately to send a message to the politicians about who was really in charge. But enormous effects of all of this is that we've now got a new nuclear, and amazingly the environmentalists such as Extinction Rebellion have got nothing to say about these new nuclear power stations. We've got one here being built at Hinkley C, and announced today was the building of a new Sizewell nuclear power station along the same, well, very questionable design as the Hinkley C reactor. So let's have a listen now to the BBC earlier this week, where on the day of the announcement of Sizewell's go-ahead, which is basically going to be built by the French, there was quite a good little discussion between Professor Michael Fitzpatrick, a university professor, and someone from Stop Sizewell, Alison Downs. I mean, you could also comment before this, isn't it interesting that the university professors are the ones who are a bit very pro-nuclear? They're not saying, well, actually, this might not be a good idea, and questioning the efficacy of whether or not this reactor design even works. We've seen it breaking down over in China, this design, for a year, that just after the reactor was switched on. But no, the universities are now telling us how wonderful nuclear is, and there's really no balance in that, as we were hearing last week from David Hughes, Dr. David Hughes at Lincoln University, saying, well, actually, no, most of the universities are now funded by industry. And obviously, Professor Michael Fitzpatrick, we're about to hear, is funded by the nuclear industry in one way or another in his position at the university. But we've also got, on the other side, there is, as I said, Stop Sizewell's Alison Downs, who, for me, wins the argument hands down.
Unlike Hinkley Point C, where all of that cost and time overspend is being paid for by EDF and CGN, its Chinese partner, at Sizewell C, our energy bills will start to see a nuclear tax go on from the day construction starts, and we'll be paying that tax throughout construction for a decade or more before a single light bulb is lit. And that's on top of a taxpayer's investment going in. And EDF has got experience at building this reactor before. It's got four other builds, all of which were disastrously late and overspent. One of the only operating ones in China was offline for 12 months because of fuel failure. So this is a huge amount of money to invest in a reactor technology that hasn't really proven itself.
What's your reaction to that, Professor? Do you think there hasn't been enough evidence of this type of technology, of the particular design of this nuclear power plant to prove its efficacy?
No, I don't think that's the case, because this is very much an evolution of the previous designs that have been operated for pressurized water reactors. And it's taken on board decades of experience of operating these plants around the world. It is a very complex plant, and part of that complexity comes from inherent safety systems that have got greater active components, where there is active intervention in the event of an issue, and also passive components, so that if there's power failures, that you don't get the sorts of issues you had with at Fukushima, with not being able to cool the reactor in the event of an outage. And in response to the particular issue of the China plant, I mean, that was because of an issue with the fuel pins and the cladding of the fuel. And that's not specific to the reactor design. That could happen in any PWR reactor type. So I think that the plants are now starting to come online and operate. There have been issues in the supply chain. I think that's entirely right. There have been issues in relearning the experience. But part of it is to say, because we have had this hiatus in the build for nuclear, we are now far more reliant on gas, which has got very expensive. And if we'd have taken the decision to build this 20 years ago, we would now have operating plant. We would have a more secure energy supply. Given that we've got the design, we can get it into operation. It is now the right time to be doing this.
Alison, let me bring you back in. Yeah. Isn't there a case for taking the longer view here and saying, yes, the government's looking at more onshore wind farms? The Prime Minister has his own difficulties with that issue at the moment, but that there needs to be another option, and that you've got to take that longer term view. I hear that what you're saying about the bills and any extra taxes that may go on to bills, but surely this long term view of Britain's energy security and energy independence has to be taken into account. What do you make of that argument?
Well, we don't consider Sizewell C to offer the UK energy independence. I mean, it's reliant on a French developer. I'd like to encourage the professor to talk to the Office of Nuclear Regulation about whether the root cause of the problems in China have been understood, because we don't think that's the case. It's now looking like they may need to go to overseas investors, which means that the money from, you know, hard-pressed households is going to go straight out of the country. And we're talking about a technology that's reliant on overseas uranium fuel. So, you know, there's a big question mark about that. And because of the exceptionally long delivery time of a gigawatt project like Sizewell C, we're going to see our energy landscape be transformed in the meantime. And the irony is that nobody's...
What would the alternative be? What would your alternative be, Alison?
Well, we've seen increasing numbers of energy models that show that very high levels of renewables, with just the small amount of nuclear that Hinkley Point C and Sizewell B's life extension would provide, are the least cost option. We're going to see great advances in storage in the future as well. I mean, the government admits its own modelling has failings in trying to sort of predict how that would roll out. But I mean, our sense is that Sizewell C is not only not needed, but we could be spending £30 billion on a project that by the time it's built isn't, you know, going to contribute anything.
Alison Downes and Professor Michael Fitzpatrick.
Well, God bless the BBC. Great little debate there with all sorts of facts put on the table. The main, well, 30 billion this is going to cost, apparently. I remember when we were told that Hinkley C was going to cost 10 billion. Well, now that's running up towards 30 billion. So three times what we were told it's going to cost. And the worst, the big blow at Hinkley, I don't know if our guests have seen this week, is that the Somerset-based project, which initially had a target date of 2025, may not, we're told this week, be ready until 2036. According to a new contract between the government and EDF, Hinkley will still be funded even if it doesn't start operating a decade after its original deadline. This contract sparked fears a delay could become a reality. The plant was delayed till mid-2020. It comes after the plant was delayed till mid-2027. So we're now hearing that the EDF have decided that they want paying for building Hinkley and for the electricity coming out of it, even though the plant, Martin, won't be switched on potentially up until 2036. It doesn't sound to me as if this this technology is really up to the job.
Well, I mean, the economics of it sound absolutely bonkers, don't they? I mean, it's just ridiculous. Why we surely in a free market, you shouldn't have to subsidise a technology like this, which is the whole thing of nuclear technology. Renewable technology, you could say, well, if we subsidise this, eventually we'll be able to produce solar panels with bigger production runs and so on, and the cost will go down. With nuclear energy, on the other hand, it seems that the cost's just going the other direction.
OK, well, look, what's nuclear doing is it's replacing the bog-standard old coal-fired and gas-fired power stations, and it seems that many of those, particularly the coal-fired ones, have been shut down before the nuclear stuff is ready to go, which just seems to me like a car crash waiting to happen. Well, what do you make of this, Judy?
Well, I think it's not just fuel, is it? It's everything. It seems to me that they're aiming to create huge shortages. I mean, there's shortages in terms of healthcare, certainly. There's shortages in terms of food, especially on the horizon, because, you know, there's 30% of farms in Holland, for example, that are now going to be taken over and wilded. I just feel that the projection into the future is actually to reduce output in everything, both fuel, food, everything that people need in order to maintain their health, and also cutting back on health provision, certainly face-to-face health provision, and turning it all into AI. I just feel everything is failing, and I can't see that failing is anything other than planned, because why would so many systems be failing all at the same time?
Yeah, well, good question. Martin, what do you make of this amazing energy policy where you cross your fingers and hope for the best with nuclear? You then look over at China and you see how this identical plant that switched on over there, they had to switch it off almost immediately for a year when it was switched on. It's now back on again, apparently. But this technology is not proven, and yet we put all our eggs in one basket.
Well, I think the nuclear lobby have they've battened onto the whole climate change thing. You know, nuclear is climate friendly, supposedly, even though, of course, to construct a nuclear power station, you need loads of energy. They don't just grow.
Yeah.
And of course, you've got to get the uranium. And of course, the uranium mining is incredibly destructive in South Africa. There's people, you know, and all the rest of it. This is where these things come from. And just focusing on the you see, they're pushing the whole, you know, Russia, you know, Putin's evil war in the Ukraine. All of these people saying, well, the arms manufacturers saying, great, this is ka-ching for us. We're going to have to replace all these shells that are being used, tanks, etc. The nuclear industry getting on and saying, well, you know, we need energy independence, and we can get that through nuclear power, which is why, of course, you had nuclear power in Japan, because they didn't have any other sources of energy. So it was a strategic thing that we've got to have some nuclear power because we need it. But of course, it does nothing to solve the immediate energy crisis. Chucking a load of money at building a nuclear power plant, which may or may not be functioning in 2027 or 2036 or whatever it is going to do nothing to bring down energy bills this winter, is it? Mm. It just ain't. It's just not realistic. And of course, we need to move to a different kind of energy system. Probably we do. But this is just, you know, there's a lot of vested interest battening on to the crisis that we're in.
I think
it's an ill wind that blows nobody to good.
Ian Davis's article about the accelerationists accelerating towards a dark enlightenment, where he explains, and I think it's very difficult to argue with it, that the solution to the energy crisis and the climate crisis may be worse than the climate crisis, so-called climate crisis. There's Mark Kennedy, Martin, as well. This is a point I mentioned earlier, which I've not really heard discussed anywhere, is that the guy who was behind the shutdown of the coal-fired Drax power station and obviously infiltrated these environmental groups was behind the policy to do with Extinction Rebellion of its day. Is guy Mark Kennedy was actually working for the police. So, and he apparently was the guy who was providing the transport, one of the leaders of the campaign, and yet he wasn't actually a campaigner at all, he was a policeman.
Yeah, well, a lot of the cops that were in the special demonstration squad, they tended to be physically active type guys because they were cops, and they were the ones who had to climb to the top of the cranes and stuff.
I saw that at the time, and I thought, here's some environmentalists that really care. No. It was the police.
Well, look, all of these organisations have been infiltrated for years. I mean, the McDonald's, too, years ago, when they stood trial for supposedly libelling McDonald's.
Dave and Helen.
Yes, but the actual leaflet was written by an undercover police officer. I mean, you couldn't make it up. But, of course, this is you know, we're in a... People have failed to grasp how big the deep state is in the West. It's enormous. The Office of Homeland Security, which didn't exist before 9/11, employs over 1 million people. It's extraordinary. Just like a mushroom. And what do these people do all day? Well, they go online and they spread disinformation and call it fact-checking. And it's all paid for by your taxes, folks.
Well, just staying with the climate crisis, so-called, we have an interview now with a woman called Dr. Judith Curry. She is a climate scientist, climatologist, and so let's have a listen to her. She says there's no emergency, so Extinction Rebellion have basically just got it wrong.
I've been in the field for a while. I got my PhD in 1982, and I was studying the weather and climate of the Arctic, actually. And that became very timely when one of the biggest concerns about global warming was the Arctic sea ice. And I gradually, my research over many decades now has, four decades really, has spanned many topics in weather and climate. But over the last decade, I've focused primarily on climate dynamics, extreme weather events, predictability and prediction, and some philosophy of science issues really related to what we can learn from models, understanding uncertainty and ignorance, and social psychology issues surrounding how we interpret all this. So my interests have sort of expanded, and I also do a lot of at this point, I'm no longer at Georgia Tech. I am president of Climate Forecast Application Sector, and I work a lot with people having to make real decisions. Everything from electricity utility providers to insurance companies to farmers in Pakistan and India. So a range of applications that I'm working on.
Your name comes up with a couple of other scientists who doubt the scientific consensus on climate change. What is your view on climate change?
Okay, first I'm going to talk about the sociology of why certain people have been separated out as heretics or even called deniers. You know, that the basic facts of the situation are pretty clear. The temperatures, global temperatures have been warming. Humans emit CO2 into the atmosphere. CO2 has an infrared emission spectra, which overall acts to warm the planet. But there's a lot of disagreement about the most consequential issues. How much of the warming has been human caused? How important is human-caused warming relative to solar variability, ocean circulation patterns, and so on? So there is some very legitimate disagreements, you know, about this topic. And myself and others that are in this category that you're talking about, we don't dispute the basics. What we do object to is the idea of a manufactured consensus for political purposes. This is not a natural scientific consensus that has emerged over a long time. It's a manufactured consensus of scientists, you know, at the request of policymakers, which has been too narrowly framed. There's too much politics in it. And, you know, that's what I object to, and there's a number of other scientists that object to this as well. And because, and we've also been critical of the behavior of some of the more politically active scientists who are exaggerating the truth in the interests of a good story or political objectives or whatever. So that's what it's about. It's not about any fundamental scientific disagreement other than maybe levels of confidence, you know, in certain findings.
Well, I'd like to come back to the politics in this whole scenario, but for now, it seems to have changed in terms of terminology. It was global warming, and then that shifted to climate change, and recently it's now a climate emergency. Other than global warming being a component of climate change, what potential reasons are there for this shift in terminology?
Well, people are trying to figure out how they're going to get people's attention. Okay, now it's not, now they use global heating. Heating sounds more dangerous than warming. Warming sounds sort of nice. So the attention, I mean, the attention has really shifted to these extreme weather events, you know, hurricanes and floods and heat waves and whatever. But there's very little evidence to tie. I mean, that's really part of natural weather and climate variability. You know, any signal from global warming usually can't be teased out in terms of these events. And attempting to say, oh, this is global warming, you know, the floods in Pakistan and Hurricane Ian and whatever, you know, it's possible that there's a minuscule component from the overall global warming, but it's very difficult to tease out from natural variability. These events would have happened anyways, you know, with possibly some minor change associated with the warming, but you can't really decipher that in an objective way. So, but people are trying to, you know, there's a whole bunch of complicated motives here. You know, people's worldview, their politics, career investments in a certain narrative, wanting to play various political games. If you're an academic scientist working in the climate area and you want to advance and get grant money and professional recognition, you would be well served to hew to the alarmist narrative. I mean, the people who are getting professional recognition and being put in charge of big institutes and centers are all alarmists. I mean,
So that's Dr. Judith Curry. I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Fascinating chat she gives there. And she's basically saying, Judith, there is no emergency. This is just not the case.
I tend to agree with her. I think that there are the scientists, again, that have had a different perspective on climate issues. I haven't being allowed to be heard. So I think that in terms of my experience of the media, I can see the same censorship happening there. I also think that one of the things that is that people can actually see certain things, like, for example, they can see that children are getting sick from pollution, that there are sort of like pollution issues in cities. I think there is overuse of plastic, and when they show the plastic in the ocean, I think that is an issue. I don't think that we're dealing with waste properly.
You and talking about plastic back in the 1960s, this is not going to be any good, this stuff. Let's stop using it. Let's carry on using glass, metal and things like that. that?
Absolutely. So I think that people confuse these sorts of things that they can see because they've all been lumped into the environment, climate, global warming issue. So people see one side of that and it actually strikes real with them, and therefore they swallow the whole thing without looking at the rest of the science relating to climate issues. So I can see why so many people do belong to XR, and I do have friends who are in XR and are very active, and they don't do it because they are sort of like swayed by the media. They do it because of what they've seen with their own eyes makes them think that something needs to be done.
Well, something does need to be done, but not necessarily closing the M25.
No. You know,
maybe shutting down a shareholder meeting Shell.
I think quite a good thing to do would be closing down the American military, because 15% of carbon comes from the American military and only 8%, I think, from farming. So I think let's keep farming going and get rid
shut
of the American
military. What a great way to finish. Yeah. Look, anyway, if people want to follow your work, what's the best way to find you, Judith?
Well, I think that I'm unfindable at the moment because I'm hardly using Facebook, so I think that maybe you'll have to invite me onto your show more frequently.
Oh, right, okay. Well, that's fine, and especially if you come on the bus and you don't come in your electric car and you get stranded in Bristol because you can't charge it up to get home. So it would be lovely to have you back a bit more frequently in the future, Judy. Thanks ever so much for that, especially on all this propaganda topic. But anyway, we're going to also hear now, again on climate, from a woman called Rosa Corrie. Now, she's one of the first people to alert me many years ago, to some of the problems with Agenda 21 and this hijacking of the whole environmental agenda. She sadly died last year. Anyway, this is a bit of her talking about how sustainable development. What exactly is that really all about? It sounds lovely, but this term has been completely hijacked and misused and abused by some of the big companies involved in trying to basically hijack the environmental movement. So here's Rosa Corrie now, passed away last year.
I was valuing property for the government so that the government could acquire that property for road projects. And what I found about 10 years ago around 10 or 13 years ago, was that land actually, it was very difficult to say what it was worth because you couldn't know what people could do with it because they were being restricted from using their property. And as I explored that and found that it wasn't just in the San Francisco Bay Area where I was working, it was in fact all across the nation and the world, I looked behind that and I found United Nations Agenda 21, Sustainable Development. We created the Post Sustainability Institute in order to educate people about the economic, social, political, and environmental impacts of communitarianism on the world. And communitarianism is that concept, that social and political construct that says that the individual's rights should be balanced against the rights of the community. And of course, the community is that amorphous, undefined community that we, you know, when we talk about community, we think we're, of course, part of it and that, you know, it's a positive thing. But really, community is constructed. It's constructed of non-governmental organizations, corporations, and government in order to dictate and regulate what it is that happens around the world. And we, as individuals, have literally no influence on that unless we are in agreement with it. If you dissent against the community, against communitarian law, or against communitarian social tactics, you're rejected and basically made an outcast. And that is something that that we wanted to expose to the world. And the reason that that we created the Post Sustainability Institute was in order to sue. We sued our local government, and right now we're suing higher up in order to stop regional plans, because regionalization is the stepping stone to globalization, and globalization is the standardization of all systems. So that includes water, law enforcement, education, energy. All systems have to be brought into harmony in order to control them all, because when systems don't meet, when they're out of balance or not in sync with one another, they can't be controlled centrally. And the goal of Agenda 21 is one world government and total control from a central unit.
So that's Rosa Corey, died last year. She's saying there, Martin, that there is a these Sustainable Development Goals of UN Agenda 21, now Agenda 2030, that actually it's an attempt to basically a power grab.
Yeah, I think the original use of the word sustainability, I think, was in the Brundtland Report, which came out in the 1980s, and it was defined as development which fulfills the needs of the current generation without prejudicing the rights of future generations. And in a sense that's unarguable. You know, we shouldn't be messing the planet up so that future generations are left with the mess. But of course, what's happened in the intervening period is that the big powers in the West, you know, the big corporations, the media and so on, have jumped on this bandwagon, and they want to control what that's supposed to mean. Yeah? So they're telling everybody, no, what it means is electric cars funded by us and all the rest of it.
Well, I mean, this is the perfect kind of controlled opposition, isn't it? You allow a genuine opposition to emerge, and then you just do a hostile takeover.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they do that anyway. I mean, the Borg adapt and assimilate, as I used to say in Star Trek. You know, if there was any genuine opposition, they would try and infiltrate it and try and steer it in a direction. And also, they just create stuff out of whole cloth. You know, they just create whole, completely different, you know, political movements, like, you know, for example, you know, all sorts of things. But I mean, the corporations are you know, the deep state that is a servant of the corporations are very, you know, they spend a lot of time thinking about how they can control agendas, how they can steer populations,
and use
and so
it
on.
To make money. I mean,
of course, there's always money to be made for
this.
This
is what our local council is now doing. They're saying we want clean air in Bristol, so they give planning permission for a whole host of incinerators just upwind of us in Avonmill, covering us with pollution, and yet they're charging everybody, including disabled people and taxi drivers, £9 a day to come into the city, which is actually, I mean, particularly for the cab drivers who are obviously going to be in the city centre all day long or every single day, that's an extra £3,500 that goes through every single taxi driver straight into the coffers of the city council week after week. So really, it is a money making exercise. ITV West this week did have a, as this is our final item before the break, ITV West had a little report on the first day of the Clean Air Zone here in Bristol, where people have to pay, and they focused on the taxi drivers, which is one of the most ridiculous and horrific concepts, that individual cabbies should have to pay. Because, I mean, this is the hypocrisy of this I find so unbelievable, Marty. But not, never mind the whole business with the disabled people. But taxis actually are a way that people can leave their cars at home. So if you come in on the train, you can then take a cab to wherever it is you're going, and you've left your car at home. But no, this city council decides it wants to tax these taxi drivers too, just as if they're ordinary car drivers. Well, it's obviously just being done for the money, isn't it? Don't you think?
Well, I mean, we've had this debate week after week. I think they should be exempt,
shouldn't they? Cabs should obviously be exempt.
Well, and maybe disabled people as well. But we've gone from a very, very big topic about sustainability and the corporations running things to, you know, essentially...
This is the cutting edge. Bringing in a zone, so-called for clean air, which has got nothing to do with clean air at all, but it's all about sustainable development goals.
Well, they would argue that they're trying to reduce the improve air quality and all the rest of it.
Shut down the incinerators. This is
a local dispute in Bristol, which is related to the bigger topic
all over the country.
Yes,
Manchester and Leeds. Yeah. The clean air zones have been shut down by legal action.
Yeah, well, maybe that's will happen here. I don't know. But what is probably what I'm more worried about is there's going to be a massive crash in the global economy. Yeah, yeah. Nobody's going to be able to afford taxi fares.
In the background to all of this, right. There is exactly.
we're
nobody's going to be able to afford to pay the charge.
Yeah,
This is the stupid thing about it. Anyway, not that our Labour council cares, our Labour mayor cares. Anyway, let's have a listen now to this report from ITV this week on the first day of the new clean air zone here in Bristol.
Ben McGrail has been getting reaction on today as the charges came in.
As drivers tackled Monday's rush hour in Bristol this morning, some faced a new and costly challenge. The clean air zone covering much of the city centre. Cameras will capture whether older, higher polluting vehicles have entered it and need to pay a fee. And they might be a fixture of Bristol's roads, but the famous Blue Hackney Carriage taxis aren't excused from paying if they don't meet the criteria. Drivers like Shanti say many of his friends and colleagues have left to drive private hire cars instead of upgrading their blue ones.
Yes, I talk to a lot of drivers nowadays, because a lot of drivers, they bought it, small cars. Because usually we got the wheelchair, but no one can afford to buy a wheelchair car, because it must be electric one. So everyone got the private car and buy a small car. That's what and less hackneys.
Bristol City Council says the zone, which includes Temple Mead Station, will improve air quality by reducing harmful emissions. But taxi drivers here say with potentially fewer drivers willing to bear the cost, they're concerned for people who rely on them.
Lots of drivers do the school run for the disabled or the wheelchair user children, and people will be, especially with the elderly people, people with the special need, people with the wheelchair, they will be in difficulties to find a blue cab.
Well, of course, it's not just taxi drivers that will be affected by the clean air zone charges. I drove into the zone today, so I've checked online on the government website to see whether I owe anything. No charge for me today, but this is where I'd pay if I did owe something.
And the fee varies depending on what you're driving. Older, non-compliant cars will be charged £9 a day. Taxis will also pay £9, as will older light goods vehicles. HGVs will pay £100, as will buses and coaches. The council says over 71% of vehicles travelling into Bristol already meet the zone's emissions standards, and all the information is on its website. It expects that number to increase in the coming years as more people switch to cleaner vehicles or different modes of transport. Whilst not everyone has welcomed the zone, it is hoped it will benefit children, older people and those with health problems, as this place joins the likes of Bath, Bradford and Birmingham as the latest city hoping to reduce emissions and clean the air. Ben McGrail, ITV News, Bristol.
Yeah, so clean the air apparently, but you're not really going to clean the air much, because all you need to do is buy a brand new car, Martin. You'd be fine, whether it's electric, petrol or diesel. You don't pay anything with a brand new car, but anyone with older cars will be paying.
Well, I mean, if you remember in the 1950s, they brought in rules that have stopped people from having coal fires. And everybody was saying that, we're totally dependent on coal fires, and lots of people were very unhappy about it, but it worked, and this may work, or it may not. If it doesn't work, then it's definitely been a waste of time. If it does work, and there's some costs involved in it, then that'll have to be seen as things proceed.
Will it work with cab drivers having to pay, with disabled people having to pay? I mean, they're cab drivers. That what you're saying there is that you have to, if you want to have a, I mean, there's going to be all sorts of trouble for the, I mean, the disabled are going to be hit doubly, aren't they? Because they're even going to be finding it more difficult to get a disabled cab, he was saying there, because the cab drivers are finding it far too expensive to buy a new disabled cab, which has to be electric. That's what he said.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing about any change like this is it's going to be painful for certain sections of the population. Yeah. And maybe that's not justifiable, but maybe, you know, but these things, what I suspect is going to happen is that lots of people are not going to have the money. You know, there's going to be all sorts of massive effects from economic collapse and chaos. These things are going to be relatively minor.
Well, what will be happening is lots of
what's coming
these
down
little bills,
the line.
These bills will be arriving through people's letterboxes, or maybe on email. I've no idea. Probably on their letterbox, and they'll just go straight in the bin.
Well, I mean, as you say, in Birmingham, lots of people have done exactly that. But I think you'll find that the enforcement system for the collection of debts is actually out there, as we've heard in the first part, in relation to Ruth's situation.
We're going to have a second foreign policy start, because we had Don DeBar just now, after the break. We'll be looking at Rishi Sunak and his Guildhall speech, the Lord Mayor's Banquet, which is about a million miles away from where most people live.
Almighty God, you gave such grace to your apostle St. Andrew that he readily obeyed the calling of your Son Jesus Christ and followed him without delay, bringing his brother with him. Grant us the same spirit of cheerful obedience, that we may give ourselves willingly to share in the witness of your church to the whole world, through Jesus Christ our Lord, who lives and reigns with you and the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen.
Illuminati, a secret society do exist. Illuminati, myself the moment that you were gone. I scare myself and I let my thoughts run. And when I run in, I keep thinking of you. And when I run in, what can I do?
From the days when, well, when they used to actually make music, and some excellent music there. That was from 1984. Before that, we heard Fatboy Slim with Illuminati, much more recently, 2002. And before that, the Reverend Neil Gardiner introducing us a hymn. I think it's a hymn to St. Andrew. Not sure the actual title of the hymn. Couldn't even make out the first line. I did have a listen, proper listen. That's from, he's from Canongate Kirk in Edinburgh. So, Martin, I'm going to give you a bit of a choice as we launch into part two of Not the BCFM Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, or even Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and me, Tony Gosling. That is, what would you think is the more important, the more interesting to listen to? Either we can hear Rishi at the Guildhall, these wonderful guilds, of course, the forerunners of the Masons, and the medieval version, I suppose you'd say, sort of little cliques where the various trades were kept safe and secret and monopolised and controlled, and the Civil War did quite a lot to try and get rid of that, those monopolies that those various guilds had. Or we can hear from the this amazing guy, well, his name is Nigel Inkster, and he popped up on my TV, and I quickly hit record. Former MI6 Director of Intelligence and Operations, talking about about Ukraine. So anyway, which would you prefer, Rishi, or who do you think is more powerful, Nigel Inkster and MI6, or Rishi Sunak at the Guildhall?
Well, it's obviously Nigel Inkster. But I think it might be useful to start with Rishi and then, and then go, if we can have both, then we'll go on to see what the true manipulators
think. Mr. Summers, your word is my command.
We will set out more detail in the updated integrated review in the new year, including how we'll work with friends in the Commonwealth, the US, the Gulf states, Israel and others. But tonight, I'd like to describe how we're already making this evolutionary leap in three other places. First, as we stand by Ukraine, we're also reinvigorating our European relationships to tackle challenges like security and illegal migration. Second, we're taking a longer-term view on China, strengthening our resilience and protecting our economic security. And third, we're seizing the huge opportunities on offer in the Indo-Pacific by building deep and long-lasting partnerships. First, Ukraine. In Kyiv, I just saw how Russia's focus is shifting from bruising encounters on the battlefield to brutalizing the civilian population. It was written in the scarred buildings and the piles of rubble lining the streets. In the stories of the first responders I met from liberated Kherson, from the torture chambers to the booby traps left in children's toys. As the world comes together to watch the World Cup, I saw how an explosive device had been hidden inside a child's football, seeking to make it a weapon of war. It defies belief. So be in no doubt, we will stand with Ukraine for as long as it takes. Next year, we will maintain or even increase our military aid, and we will provide new support for air defence to protect the Ukrainian people and the critical infrastructure they rely on. By protecting Ukraine, we protect ourselves. With the fall of Kabul, the pandemic, the economic strife, some said the West was weak. In fact, our response in Ukraine has shown the depth of our collective resolve. Sweden and Finland are joining NATO. Germany is increasing its defence spending. Partners as far afield as Australia, Japan and South Korea are standing with us. We've developed an entirely new sanctions model. And through NATO and the Joint Expeditionary Force, we're guarding against further Russian aggression, whether in the east or the high north. We're also evolving our wider post-Brexit relations with Europe, including bilaterally and engaging with the new European political community. But this is not about greater alignment. under my leadership will never align with EU law. Instead, we'll foster respectful, mature relationships with our European neighbours on shared issues like energy and illegal migration to strengthen our collective resilience against strategic vulnerabilities. And that brings me to my second point. We also need to evolve our approach to China. Now, let's be clear, the so-called golden era is over. Along with the naive idea that trade would automatically lead to social and political reform. But nor should we rely on simplistic Cold War rhetoric. We recognise China poses a systemic challenge to our values and interests. A challenge that grows more acute as it moves towards even greater authoritarianism. Instead of listening to their people's protests, the Chinese government has chosen to crack down further, including by assaulting a BBC journalist. The media and our parliamentarians must be able to highlight these issues without sanction, including calling out abuses in Xinjiang and the curtailment of freedom in Hong Kong.
So that's a little section of Rishi Sunak's speech, Martin. You and I were debating whether this is a speech made by the Chancellor, but no, it's every November by the Prime Minister. If you go back to medieval times when the guilds were in their heyday, it was the monarch that made speeches to the Guildhall. Now, and occasionally the Queen does still, or did, and the King will. But it's now mainly the Prime Minister. So what is the significance of these people? It's basically the City of London, isn't it, that he's talking
to? It is,
to.
And they are actually a separate... They're not part of the UK constitution, are they? The City of London is separate. It has its own separate...
It's another country, a bit like the Vatican or something.
That's right, yeah.
So, but I mean, this is the city, these are the investors. A lot of this is about investment, but really it's the most, I mean, it's an ossified kind of organisation, this, that, you know, surely, what on earth, who are these people? And aren't they really driving a lot of the policy that we're seeing at the moment?
Well, I mean, there's somebody appointed by the city who sits behind the Speaker's chair in Parliament to remind of the city's privileges. And so this obeisance by the political leadership of the United Kingdom to the City of London, this is its manifestation. And of course, what he's doing there is he's telling the City of London what the general policy is, which no doubt they all know that we're basically going to go to war with Russia and China, except we're not going to go to war with them. Did I use the word war? No, I didn't, apart from all of the other rhetoric that we heard. You know, I mean, why do people believe when the Ukrainian secret services say that they found a football with a bomb in it left by the Russians? They just go, oh, right, that must be true. Now, that may or may not be true. But it's not the sort... I mean, you know, you can imagine Rishi Sunak being shown this football by the Ukrainian secret services.
And the other...
It's just like, why do you believe that?
Why... Well, the other comment he was making was about...
Why do you believe it?
These new... A new kind of sanctions.
Well, the new kind of sanctions model, that was causing some mirth here in the studio, folks. Because the new kind of...
I'm sure at home, too.
The new kind of sanctions model is, we're going to cut our own throats to spite the Russians.
These are sanctions that actually affect us far worse than they do.
Well, they do.
So-called target.
That's right. So, I mean, they're doubling down on nonsense here. And the Russians are pretty much aware of, I mean, they lost 300 billion of their assets, which were just seized. And they've written that off. They know they won't see a penny of that.
But
they're getting more money now from selling energy into the current energy market.
These guilds
for
that,
less
Martin,
supply.
These guilds.
How's
are not,
that going
are not,
to bring them to their knees?
Are not elected, are they? They're not elected.
Well, of course not. They represent. I mean, it's a showcase for the relationship between the sort of elected government and the City of London, which has an independent power, which is, you know, they're not even part of the British Constitution. They've got their own police force.
Apparently, back in 2012, when David Cameron gave the speech, he was talking about the wonders, the great opportunities, and how wonderful China was, and, you know, this is the future, everyone.
Well, don't forget that one of the things we were promised when we left the European Union is that we were going to do all these trade deals with Southeast Asia, most, of course, meaning China.
Well, my point I'm trying to make, though, is that the United States seems to have hijacked that China policy into an aggressive policy rather than a positive one.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is what's happened. They've thought that what would happen if they allowed the Chinese into the World Trade Organization and allowed them to develop in the way that they have, that they would eventually evolve into a capitalist-friendly state.
But he's right. I mean, he's right. Rishi Sunak's right about one thing. It's not going too well for the Chinese with all these protests against the lockdowns, is it?
Well, the situation in China is very complex. As you know, Tony, I think that the COVID-19 was deliberately created and used as a way to try and bring the giant Chinese economy down.
Yeah, but the Chinese Communist Party seems to be helping by bringing in these ridiculous, very strict lockdowns.
Yeah, but don't forget that when we were still going through lockdown, the Chinese were well out of lockdown, and they've had our economy
lockdown. No. They have more and more all the time.
Yes,
they just keep
they
having
are.
Lockdown after
yeah.
lockdown.
But their economy is still growing, Tony, and ours isn't.
This is an experiment on using these COVID passes, etc., to try and control the population. It's not working, is it?
Well, don't forget that the protests don't necessarily represent majority opinion.
Were they being run by the American embassy or something?
Well,
the
some of them undoubtedly,
or the British embassy?
Some of them undoubtedly are. You can be sure of that, Tony. Just as the protests in Iran aren't entirely innocent either. They're all happening in Baluchistan and in Kurdistan, where there's a massive intervention by Western intelligence services and the Israelis.
Politicisation going on in China right now, anyway. Fascinating to see. Anyway, just give you, it's only about a minute long, but it's the wind-up of Sunak's speech, where he name-checks, guess who? Our favourite Henry Kissinger.
Freedom and openness have always been the most powerful forces for progress. But they have never been achieved by standing still. As Henry Kissinger wrote, during periods of crisis, whether war, technological change, or economic dislocation, management of the status quo may be the riskiest choice of all. Under my leadership, we won't choose the status quo. We will do things differently. We will evolve, anchored always by our enduring belief in freedom, openness, and the rule of law, and confident that in this moment of challenge and competition, our interests will be protected and our values will always prevail. Thank you.
So, I find it fascinating that he feels it necessary to name-check Kissinger. This is pressing all the right buttons with the power elite, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we're going to change, and therefore I'm going to appeal to this 90-year-old fossil war criminal as my lodestar. And that's how up-to-date and up-to-the-minute and go-ahead I am.
How has Kissinger managed to become this kind of cult figure, almost like, you can imagine all these people from the City of London with pictures of Kissinger on their wall that they just doff their hat to every day?
Well, because he was, you know, he is a major force behind the world we live in. You know, he was a very powerful character. He was never elected to anything. And of course,
well, he wasn't. He was
advisor, but he never stood in an election for anything.
He was Secretary of State.
Yes, he was Secretary of State, but nobody voted for him. He was Nixon's choice of Secretary of State. Mm. So he was dependent on Nixon to that extent.
There's some fantastic
photos. He was basically a bit like Lavrov. Lavrov is a foreign minister of Russia, but he's never been voted to Port Wales.
Is there some brilliant pictures of Kissinger stood next to Nixon, if you go back to the 1970s, where Kissinger is looking like, he's just got that expression on his face, I know something he doesn't know, and he's looking kind of guilty. Well worth tracking down some of those photos, amazing. But anyway, we're talking about China. There's a little tiny little item here, but it's funny, sometimes you hear something, you think, gosh, that's really quite significant. So this is over in Hong Kong, a guy called Jimmy Lai, who used to own a lot of the media in Hong Kong. The Chinese have decided that he's not allowed to have a barrister of his choice to defend him in court.
Hong Kong's top court has struck out the government's demand to bar the former media tycoon Jimmy Lai from hiring a British barrister to defend him in his upcoming national security trial. Lower courts had approved Tim Owen KC's appointment, but the city's Department of Justice claimed this would cause danger as the trial might involve state secrets. Today, the Court of Final Appeal ruled against the Department of Justice's application for another appeal.
Tiny little item, but it's so significant, isn't it? So this guy in Hong Kong is not allowed to have the barrister of his choice. He's got to have a barrister from China instead, from the Chinese mainland.
Yeah, well, I mean, the big picture is, in my view, that COVID-19 was a deliberate attack on the Chinese. The Chinese government is therefore responding quite robustly to what they regard as an attempt to destabilize their setup. And of course,
they're not talking about the judge. They're talking about who your legal representative is. Surely you can choose your own legal representative, can't you?
Not on the situation. The Chinese Communist Party are trying to make it clear, or the Communist Party of China, to give its proper title.
You will have our barrister, not your own.
No, exactly. In other words, this is not an entirely open and free system, any more than the one in the United States of America, where the president gets assassinated, is an entirely open and free system. Or in Saudi Arabia, our glorious ally, who are busy wrecking Yemen as we speak. They invaded the country. It's the biggest humanitarian disaster on the planet. But I didn't hear anything from Rishi Sunak about any of that. That's just not happening.
There's something funny going on with China, though, isn't there? Because Britain, according to the Daily Mail, your favourite newspaper, still gives China £51.7 million every year in foreign aid. UK sent China £51.7 million aid last year, despite a pledge to end these indefensible handouts. The cash covered climate change and reducing the illegal animal trade. So I guess that's with World Wildlife Fund and people like that, which is an intelligence operation, and human rights. Last year, then Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab vowed to cut aid to China by 95%. But no, they haven't done it. They're still sending all this money to China. Why are they doing that?
Why? They're probably putting lots of other money, which we haven't heard about, into keeping the pot boiling in Xinjiang, for example, and also to fund various people who are opposed to the Chinese government's policy. In actual fact, the reason what the British government does with foreign aid is use it, the money, to buy influence and control the situation in foreign countries, which is why when people in Britain go, well, why do we give foreign aid? Say, well, why do you think we give foreign aid? It's to try and control the countries that we give it to.
To pay for intelligence fronts?
Well, exactly. That's what it is. And, of course, the numbskulls back home can't quite grasp this. I mean, why are we giving any money to the Ukraine? It's all going down the drain. It's all being stolen and all the rest of it. And we've got an energy crisis here at home. Why aren't we insulating our own homes at our own expense instead of pouring money down the drain in the Ukraine? You know, there's no sense of where the money really goes.
Yeah.
People think that the money goes on certain things, and in actual fact, there's a massive amount of money on looking after waste.
That is kind of what
a
this
huge
show.
Huge amount of money spent on looking after nuclear
that's
waste. That's kind
of what this
goes.
Program and the press in general should be doing. You know, through current affairs programs, is scrutinising these budgets and where money is spent and on what. And it doesn't seem to do anywhere near enough of that.
Don't forget there are hidden budgets as well, which we'll never hear about.
Black budgets. Yeah, well, a lot of those. Yeah, off books. This is Oliver the North Territory.
Yes, it is.
Chaos in China, more in Beijing now. Beijing is now facing a critical COVID crisis. They say, as always, of course, that's the sort of terminology used, even though the actual variants of COVID are no longer anywhere near as dangerous as they were originally. China plunges 400 million people into lockdown, and the worst ever cases, apparently. Several other cities, including Shanghai, Guangzhou and Chongqing, have tightened COVID restrictions as cases have climbed. 412 million people in China in some sort of lockdown based on 49 cases. I mean, it's just this. You're defending this behaviour by the Chinese government still, Martin?
I think that the Chinese government are facing a very difficult situation. If somebody has made a deliberate biological warfare attack on you, and also,
yeah, but it's petered out now about 2 years ago.
No, it hasn't.
Yes, it did.
No, because there haven't been.
Yeah, when the Omicron
lots of their
variant,
people
when the Omicron
in China have
variant,
not been vaccinated.
When the Omicron variant came along, this was the absolute gift, God's gift, because it, what it did is it, if you caught it, and if you catch it, what it does is it gives you a good degree of immunity to the original nasty COVID, and yet it really just like catching a cold. So what is the point of carrying on with this madness?
What's the point is once you've committed to the policy of zero COVID without using mRNA
vaccines...
Are
we going to have another revolution now in China?
No, we are not. No, we are not. The Chinese system is actually quite robust, which is why they've actually survived the economic costs of COVID far better than the United States of America or Britain or any of the major Western countries. But of course, if it's a deliberate attack, and I think it is, as Kirillov, the head of the Russian chemical and biological warfare troops, has said, the Chinese and the Russians went to the United States, they went to the United States, to the United Nations, and said, we want people to be looking into these biological warfare labs that we've discovered in the Ukraine. Now, in actual fact, in my view, the war in the Ukraine and the COVID-19 crisis are all part of World War III, just as the attack on 9/11 was part of World War III. And I'm afraid World War III is going to get a lot messier and a lot more problematic in China, in India, in this country, all over the world. It's going to get nastier because once you've started things like this, it's very hard to stop.
Well,
them.
There's going to be some retribution, that's for sure. But the question is the whole idea of this Wuhan lab with the Pentagon there, was that actually the Americans and the Chinese collaborating to cause chaos?
No.
Well, you say no. I would suggest to you that James Corbett and Whitney Webb would disagree, as they had an interesting program last week, which was called China and Wall Street, the New Global Economy. So let's have a little listen. And this is Whitney's Unlimited Hangout, which is one of the best shows in the world, obviously way better than this one, but it's pretty good. And so this is about 5 minutes of Whitney Webb discussing the links between the US New World Order and the Chinese.
Since the COVID era began, fear-mongering and warmongering about China has been on the rise. Though there has been some truth to some of the points raised, there has also been a lot of disinformation and war propaganda thrown at the public, particularly in the West, both before COVID and since. But consistently, the narrative has been that this is a power struggle of nation state versus nation state. And this narrative, of course, fails to account for the elite influencers and transnational power structures that unite China and the West behind the scenes. And because this critical aspect of the situation is hardly ever discussed, it's not common knowledge at all, and many are completely unaware that the key factions of the powers that be of U.S. empire overlap considerably with the powers that be in China. These related power factions in both countries are part of a larger transnational elite that we've also seen a lot more of in the COVID era, as they've been at the forefront of promoting global governance, the fourth industrial revolution, and the so-called Great Reset. So in order to really understand this transnational effort to enact these agendas globally, we must examine the power structures driving them behind the guise of countries that we are told are antagonists and are to some degree, but also share a lot more than the public has been led to believe. So joining me today to discuss the realities at work here is actually the very person whose work first opened my eyes to them several years ago, James Corbett of The Corbett Report. For those not familiar with James's work, several years ago, he released a documentary called China and the New World Order that I found incredibly revealing. And since then, he's had a lot more to say on the topic in subsequent interviews and in writing. So without further ado, hey, James, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on, Whitney. This is an incredibly important topic that doesn't get enough attention. When it does, I don't think it's explored in the right way. So hopefully we can correct some of that today.
Yeah, I think we both definitely agree on that. So I think a good way to start off is to look at this Financial Times article that came out a few years ago that I think is a good way to sort of broach this subject with, the uninitiated, for lack of a better term. So this is from the Financial Times. It's called The U.S., China, and Wall Street's New Man in the Middle. Of course, there was a man in the middle before him. This is an article largely about Stephen Schwartzman, but also about a class of individuals that are basically called the New China Whisperers. And if you're not familiar with Stephen Schwartzman and Blackstone Capital, you should be. They own probably close to half of the United States. What BlackRock doesn't own, Blackstone owns. But I highlighted a few excerpts here. So I'll just read from that really briefly and then let you take it from there, James. So it says in his offices, a short walk from, I'll probably butcher the pronunciation. So from the Chinese Communist Party's leadership compound in central Beijing, Vice Premier Liu He maintains a large collection of photos taken with foreign VIPs. He's, you know, Xi Jinping's most trusted economic advisor, blah, blah, blah. But people add that one picture in Mr. Liu's collection is always on display. It shows the vice premier engrossed in conversation with Henry Kissinger. Few statesmen are as revered in Beijing as Mr. Kissinger, who is Richard Nixon's national security advisor and Secretary of State, masterminded the U.S. and China's rapprochement at a time when Mr. Xi and Mr. Liu were teenagers trying to survive the Cultural Revolution. Dr. Kissinger is a foreign policy deity in Beijing, says Drew Thompson, a former U.S. Department Defense Department official. He has always had a sympathetic ear in Beijing, and Chinese leaders have continually sought to use his celebrity and access to influence Washington. Okay, so people that have been sort of in either one of the two echo chambers that we hear a lot about China in media, either on the left or the right, especially on the left, right, which, you know, there tends to be a lot of, I guess, xenophilia these days. You know, maybe like, well, we know Henry Kissinger's a war criminal, but whoa, what's he doing there? right. So I think maybe a good place to start is explain, you know, Kissinger's role in the opening up of China, who Kissinger is connected to in terms of this transnational elite and how this sort of developed. If you want to go farther back in time, of course, that's fine. But how that sort of shaped the China of today and this power structure that we'll be exploring in this video.
Okay, so that's Whitney Webb and her Unlimited Hangout, Martin. She's saying that it's not just people like Kissinger who've been a back channel into China from the US Empire war criminal. It's also characters like this guy, Stephen Schwartzman, American billionaire businessman, chairman and chief executive of Blackstone. Funny, isn't it? Blackstone and BlackRock sound a little bit similar. And in fact, there's private equity firm Blackstone. They seem to have similar aims.
Well, there's always been a faction within the elite in the West that wants to try and work with like-minded people within the power structure in China. What they've been, if you read stuff like The Economist and so on, the thing that they're hoping for is that Xi Jinping, they don't like. They see him as dragging the country back to a more controlled system. You know, Xi Jinping basically, even though he was suffered during the Cultural Revolution, he's very much, he's a more conservative communist character than some of the kind of people that they would like to see in power. So what they always presumed would happen if they allowed the Chinese into the World Trade Organization, as they did in 2000, that gradually an elite would emerge in China, which was very much, you know, related to making money from the West, and that this elite would then open the Chinese economy up to Western predation. But that's not what's happened. The Chinese Communist Party, or the Communist Party of China, to give it its proper name, like the Communist Party of the Russian Federation, they are related parties. They basically took what they wanted from the West in terms of technology transfer and know-how, but they didn't liberalize the system economically. They didn't liberalize politically, or they did a bit, you know. I mean, obviously modern China is not the Cultural Revolution.
Well, let's just talk about Stephen Schwartzman a little bit. He's, as I say, a billionaire, chief executive of Blackstone. This private equity firm was established in 1985 with a guy called Peter Peterson, former chairman of Lehman Brothers. Ah, right, okay. That caused the 2008 crash. Okay. And he was also a Secretary of Commerce. That is Peterson, I think they're talking about here. So these people like him, though, I think we need to know a little bit more about. I mean, he's sort of what Whitney's implying there is that he's kind of taken over where Kissinger left off. And the idea is we just want to make money, whether it's in the West or in the East. We don't really care. And if we can employ fascistic technologies in the West to make that money, we will. I mean, I'm reminded a little bit of actually of John D. Rockefeller and his visits to Nazi Germany before the beginning of the war, admiring along with Himmler the concentration camps, standing outside the barbed wire looking and thinking, oh, we've got a load of prisoners here, we could use those as cheap labour.
Well, there has always, as I say, been a faction within the Western financial elites that wanted to do business with China. And there's always been a faction within China. Don't forget, China at one stage was completely closed to the outside influence. During the Cultural Revolution, there was something like a handful, like 10 people from outside China were allowed in China. Nobody else was allowed in. It was a completely enclosed society, which is enormous. Big place to close off from the international economy. They've now become absolutely central to the international economy. So as we were saying earlier, if there is a big COVID lockdown or there's an uprising in China, which I doubt will happen, then that will affect immediately. The world stock markets wobbled as a result of these protests, because it means that the Chinese are potentially not in control of the situation, which means that the Chinese will go into crisis if they do. And if they go into crisis, the global economy will go into crisis.
Which may be why they've decided to be a little bit lenient. Well, we shall see over the next few weeks. Anyway, look, we mustn't forget about Nigel Inkster, the former MI6 Director of Intelligence and Operations. I mean, that does sound like quite an important role. Maybe he knows a little bit about the death of Diana. Certainly, if I was to bump into him in the street, I'll ask about that. But let's have a listen to Nigel Inkster now, speaking on the BBC earlier this week.
These things took place over the weekend, and it's quite clear that a lot of official eyes were off the ball. This is particularly true of China's censors, who tend to be less prevalent at weekends and have allowed a lot of footage about these protests and social media around them to circulate both in and outside China. I don't expect this to last, but it's not unusual in China for protests to start off like this, we're without much in the way of an effective response to start with. That comes later, and I am confidently expecting that it will.
And what form do you think that will take?
Well, I think in the first instance, it will focus on social media, trying to close down the main transmission vectors for the protests and for the protest messaging. I think Shanghai will probably prove to be a bellwether for how the party state responds around the country, starting now to arrest people, identify where possible the ringleaders and take them out of circulation.
Let's just look in a bit more detail at the cause, the chief cause of these protests, the zero COVID policy, the continuation of that policy. We heard there the clip of Victor Gao saying it had resulted in great success, both in the low number of deaths, he said, and the low number of infections. What's your assessment of China's zero COVID policy 3 years on?
I think it's unsustainable. We're seeing the evidence of that now. I think in that sense, China's fighting a losing battle. Unfortunately, Xi Jinping at the 20th Party Congress doubled down on this policy, talking about fighting a people's war against the virus. So I don't anticipate any radical change in direction. The problem is that if China does relax zero COVID now, while infectious strains are taking hold within the country, we will see a very significant rise in the number of serious illnesses and deaths. And while as a percentage of the total population, that may not be that large, in absolute terms, the numbers will look pretty horrifying in the millions.
Nigel Inkster there.
What do you make of MI6's assessment?
Well, I mean, he's not telling us everything that he knows necessarily. You know, that's public relations, if you know what I mean. I mean, MI6 don't go out there and tell you everything they know about stuff, do they? That wouldn't be, I mean, in the past, they never made any kind of interviews with anybody at all. So, you know, it's extraordinary that we've now moved to the stage where these people are sort of media pundits.
So, I mean, as the Director of Operations and Intelligence for MI6, does that make him M?
I don't know, Tony. You'd have to ask somebody who's more
in the
know than I do.
I think it does. Anyway, so there's the guy at the top, who some say that, and I would, you know, it's impossible to know who Ian Fleming meant by using the word, the letter M, but one might say Morton, Desmond Morton, the private secretary to Winston Churchill, who was involved in all the skullduggery that we've talked about many times here on, with Martin Bormann at the end of the Second World War. But his assessment is that the Chinese have gone too far here. I mean, he seems to be obviously right.
Well, I mean, don't forget, my view is that the whole COVID scam, the plandemic, is part of warfare.
Well, we're not talking about what was going on in 2020 at the beginning. No, we're talking about now.
No, but what's
it's almost like they've stuck in a rut and they can't get out of it because
as he pointed out,
the system doesn't allow for any independent thought.
No, as he pointed out, if they do reduce their restrictive policy, there's a danger because the infections are rising at the moment. They're the highest they have been in China for a long. Don't forget, many people in China live in multi-million cities. Yeah, so it could easily spread very, very fast through the population.
House arrest, basically, for nothing.
Well, it's not for nothing, Tony.
Yes, it is
a biological war.
It's not a biological weapon anymore, is it?
It is a biological.
Omicron is one of the, like I said, it's a gift from God.
No,
it's not your original COVID that's spreading around China
now. Not to the Chinese, because the Chinese haven't been exposed
to
it.
And this is why the people are coming out on the streets.
Yes, in their hundreds.
They've had enough of it.
In their hundreds, Tony, in a population of billions.
And they're not dying of COVID. What they're doing is they're catching Omicron, they're getting a bit of a sniffle, they're blowing their nose, and they're fine.
We still haven't got through. We have these arguments periodically. I think that COVID-19 is a pandemic.
We know that. You say it every time.
Yes, but and it was deliberately released
but this
in
is
order
not
to try and mess up the Chinese economy,
and that was
which
back
was
in
just
2020.
About to
twenty.
Yes.
Now we're facing a totally different situation.
Yes, and of course,
with a much milder version of COVID.
No, what's happened in this country is we've been dosed up with mRNA vaccines to the great benefit of Pfizer and Moderna. They haven't done that in China, okay? They've got a different policy.
Mm. And I just think you're in denial about the Chinese making the wrong decisions here.
No. I think the Chinese, what's happened now in local level in China is they're saying, right, we're going to have to modify the policy because we can't just carry on with complete lockdowns, but we can't give up the idea that we're going to deal with this through administrative measures, not through using untested vaccines. And I suppose we're not going to have time this evening to go through how terrible the mRNA vaccines, the death vaccines, the
We've done that many times.
Indeed. So if you don't want to do that, you've got to do something else, and that's what they're doing.
Okay.
They're going to start sinking aircraft carriers soon. And
that's not related, is it?
No, it's not COVID, but COVID is warfare.
It's not lockdowns.
No, lockdown may be necessary.
I wonder if they're going to be able to persuade their population to get involved in any kind of war.
Well,
Join the army and that sort of thing when they're actually out on the streets.
Xi Jinping said this is a people's war against COVID. That is code for saying we are at war with the United States of America and the British.
For clamping down on the population and actually destroying all their civil liberties.
Now listen, the civil liberties, it's very interesting the way the Western media have reported on this. Either it's a protest against the COVID lockdowns or, which is what they really want, is it's against the system of rule in China run by the Communist Party. So if the people are going
or
out...
Both.
Or both. But in actual fact, you will find that that millions of people in China live in places where there are no lockdowns and no protests. It's a very, very big place. Much, much bigger than Britain. They're saying that 415 million, I saw the figure earlier, you wrote it down, 415 million people are under lockdown.
400 million, yeah.
Yeah, there's a billion people in China.
So it's only a tiny amount.
It's only a tiny amount of the population,
isn't
it?
It's not tiny, is it? 400 million.
It's big.
All those souls are getting rather annoyed. Anyway,
no,
we're going to go
not
on
some
now.
Of some people are not protesting, they're just going along with the policy.
We're now going to move on to our final item, which is to look at psychiatry and psychology and philosophy with Anton Chaitkin and Barry Smith. Anyway, Martin, we'll say goodbye to you. But Anton is going to be talking here about the history. Well, it's a part of an excerpt from his talk about the history of the British financial empire. He's ex-LaRouche. His father was Jacob Chaitkin, the chief strategist of the Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany in the United States in the Second World War, just before the Second World War, which was broken, by the way, by the Zionists. This term Zio-Nazi, I've always been a bit uncomfortable with that, except now we've got Zelensky, and he seems to have made it real, that term. But anyway, this is Anton Chaitkin talking about psychiatry and the history of the British messing around with this and using it to, I suppose, to bamboozle the public with psychological warfare.
We've had a really rough century. You know, we've had a rough century. You go back to World War I, completely senseless war. World War II, massive bloodbath, unprecedented in human history, at least in Europe anyway. And then you have the threat of nuclear annihilation, the times that we're all alive, and a pretty dangerous time right now, right? With people running around murdering people in church or in while they're praying, right, en masse, to try to provoke something. Let's see what this party has been doing in this. I would point your attention to a house, single house. It goes by the name of Thorpe Lodge. This is a house in England. And a gentleman named Peregrine Worsthorn grew up there. A gentleman of the highest type. I have to spell it right here. And he had a mother one time named Priscilla. I probably haven't spelled it right. She married a man who became Peregrine Worsthorn's stepfather, a guy named Montague Norman. And this was his house. So this is where Worsthorn became a mature individual and so forth. Montague Norman is famous as being the head of the Bank of England for 24 years, from 1920 to 1944, longer time than anyone else. Anybody else has just been head for 2 years. Before he was head of the Bank of England, he was a partner of Brown Brothers, a banking company, and that later merged with Harriman to become Brown Brothers Harriman. But his family firm was called Brown Brothers, and the Brown Brothers man from New York would come to Thorpe Lodge early in the century and meet with Montague Norman. They'd discuss theosophy and various occult religions. Montague Norman was a theosophist. By the way, the reason this is quite relevant now is that Peregrine Worsthorn is like the central character in the Hollinger Corporation. Writes for the Daily Telegraph. He virtually personally launched the whole Whitewater thing against Clinton. He also was the one who declared that Germany is going into a Fourth Reich and needs to be smashed. Not Hitler's Germany, because his father put Hitler into power. This democratic Germany needs to be smashed, right? So, in the 1930s, a guy named Hjalmar Schacht used to come to Thorpe Lodge all the time. He was the economics minister of Adolf Hitler. And he'd come to Thorpe Lodge, meet with Montague Norman, daddy, and discuss the budget of Nazi Germany. Well, how are we going to carry on for the next 6 months in Nazi Germany? Oh, great master head of the Bank of England who runs all world finance. And who has given the Nazi German army all of our weapons, our tanks and our machine guns, sold by British companies that you personally control, that you personally reorganized in the German marketplace until Hitler got to be sufficiently well-armed that he could carry on. And of course, his family firm, Brown Brothers Harriman, Averell Harriman, George Bush's father and other people, partners of that Anglo-American firm, paid the Nazis as they're coming up to becoming a power, the Nazi Party. So this is the pro-Hitler faction inside of England. There are people who don't appreciate Hitler in England. He, Montague Norman, convinced the various people within the British government that they should go along with Hitler. So this is the fanatically pro-Hitler faction. Not pro-German, because he figured that Germany would be weaker under Hitler than a democratic Germany, which was considered to be a threat, because they might become a strong country, a stable country, allied with other strong countries like Russia, China, Italy, etc. Then what would happen if the whole world was a bunch of strong, independent countries? Why would you need international bankers to do any particular thing? All right? Why would they have any power? Well, why am I telling you all this? Just complete on this, on the question of the mental manipulations. In the 1930s, there was a group of foundations in New York City representing Rockefeller and Harriman. One of them is called the Macy Foundation, Josiah Macy, and a few other little firms in New York. And they're the ones that now control the funding of the Cult Awareness Network and the Process Church of the Final Judgment. In those days, they were sending money over to Germany and Austria to set up psychiatric institutes to preach race purification, various forms of racial extermination, and so forth. Money coming through this and from Rockefeller Foundation, all of it controlled by this guy, head of the Bank of England, who's constantly coming back and forth to New York to coordinate this stuff. Now, oh, there's a Jewish bank involved in this, the Warburgs, who coordinated the activities of Harriman and this firm in Germany. In this book, they describe, Lansky describes, this Lansky speaks in this book all the time. This is mainly quotes from Meyer Lansky, great genius of organized crime. He says that in 1935 there was a judge in New York State, a prominent man in the Republican Party, who came to him and says, Meyer, we need to fight Nazism, and you're the man to do it. We're going to give you all the money and legal help that you need, and go fight the Nazis. Pretty weird, right? The head of organized crime? And then he went out, supposedly, and had his thugs go and engage in fist fights with brown shirts, the German-American Bund. And they'd had fist fights, they got on the news. Well, the judge was a guy named Proskauer. And Proskauer was actually in the American Jewish Committee. And that was this party that we're talking about. In other words, these are the people, they made public statements attacking my father and others who were in the boycott against Nazi Germany. In other words, this is the pro-Hitler faction of finance, including the B'nai B'rith and the American Jewish Committee. So these are the people who are supposedly paying Meyer Lansky to fight Nazism, but they didn't want Jews to fight Hitler. They didn't want boycotts against Hitler or anything like that, because they're working with the whole British party that's actually putting Hitler into power. So how'd this all end up? How did somebody like Baruch Goldstein, this guy who killed all those people while they were worshiping, get to be so crazy with racial hatred that he would do something like that? It's not based on religion, because this gang didn't get religion until a certain point. They said, well, that would be useful for our faction. So they adopted this religion at a certain point. They got to be so-called conservatives or orthodox or something. They're not, most of them are either former communists, or they're mainly anti-Western types from Russia, like Dostoevsky. Well, what happened? happened is at the end of World War II, there was a certain kind of a project to make people as crazy as possible about what had just happened in World War II. And there was a final meeting at Thorpe Lodge. Now remember, Montague Norman was a theosophist, the principal architect of the Hitler regime, and in fact of the psychiatry that was practiced under Hitler, where they started killing people and training murderers. These were psychiatrists that were coordinated by Anglo-American people. At the end of the war, they had a meeting at Thorpe Lodge to set up what was called the World Federation for Mental Health. The most insane people that had ever walked the face of the earth, right? They set this thing up, and that's what they did there in 1948 is the basis for all mental health and psychiatric organizations today on this planet. One of the meetings they had there was a meeting on the subject of guilt and how to manipulate guilt, how to use guilt. They had a specific session on German collective guilt. And off of that, they published a book called The Authoritarian Personality. That was published by Proskauer and the American Jewish Committee. That is, the pro-Nazi group in America and Britain published the literature telling you about the guilt of the German people for the crimes of Hitler. The keynote speaker at that conference on German collective guilt was Margaret Mead. And the chairman of the meeting was the head of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry's Insanity Project. Project on Insanity, run by Scottish Rite psychiatrists. He's over from America. So this is a bunch of British ghouls and their American hangers-on. They had... Carl Jung was a vice president of this Congress. Freud's daughter, Anna Freud, was a vice president. All the leading British people in the eugenics movement and all the leading British people dealing with building up the Soviet Union. Because right after the end of World War II, they didn't have Hitler anymore. So they had to have some new dictatorship in Europe, so Europe wouldn't be republic-oriented. So they brought in communism into half of Europe. That was done by the same group of people. By Harriman, remember? Harriman was the ambassador to Russia. He arranged the Yalta meeting. And this whole little clique. So they just brought in a new type of totalitarianism.
Well, Jewish brain box extraordinaire, learned Jew, Anton Chaikin there. That talk is called The History of the British Financial Empire. He did the talk, I believe, in 1994. Absolutely fascinating to see the way that the void which had been opened up by the destruction of faith, mainly Christianity in Europe, was being filled by, as he describes, these ghouls and the idea of weaponizing German guilt at the end of the Second World War. Absolutely brilliant and fascinating. And we're going to wind up this week with Barry Smith on a similar topic, looking at the philosophers and the psychiatrists in the university in a talk that he did in 1990 on the occult. He's was a New Zealand preacher, Barry Smith, that preached all over the country, came to Europe a few times, but mainly I think he was working in the Polynesian Islands and the South Pacific, etc. But that's now Barry Smith to wind today's show up.
Anybody who goes to university needs to watch this one, Colossians chapter 2. Let's turn to it, shall we? This is for the intellectuals among us. Did you know there is a spirit behind certain things that are taught at the university? One man described the university as the gateway to hell. Possibly true. Many young people go in there, they cannot handle the strain and it destroys them. If you're going to go to university, you need to be strong in the name of Jesus. I've done some degrees in there and I tell you what, she's a place of evil, but if you're a good Christian, get in there and win them for Jesus. Whatever they give you, give it back in the name of Jesus. We're reading here Colossians chapter 2 and verse 8. Let's read together about philosophy. A lot of people get involved in philosophy. Beware,
lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit, after the tradition of men and after the rudiments of the world and not after Christ. It's possible to be a great Christian, go to university, get involved in philosophy and finish up ruined. And that includes all the arts dealing with the spiritual side of man. I believe if you want to be a medical man, you can deal with the body, good. But let's leave the spiritual side to God, shall we? There is the word of wisdom, the word of knowledge, and the discernment of spirits that will deal with the spiritual side of man. If you get involved in philosophy or psychiatry or, you know, those sort of things, it's a very dangerous field unless you walk very close with God. You can sort out the problem, but can you cure the problem? And oftentimes you'll find that you promote the problem you're trying to cure, because you sow the seed in people's minds. You say to this fella, tell me what happened to you when you were a boy, and the boy loves it, you know, a bit of attention at last. He's lying back on the couch. I remember my cruel father beat me over the ear. Oh, is that right? And what happened to you? Knocked me right on the floor. Is that right? Yes, my grandmother growled at me the same day. And this stuff goes on, and the boy begins to dig up all this stuff, and he digs it up and he digs it up, and it begins to get on his mind, and all he can think about are these problems. Then he goes to someone else and he says, what do you think my problem is? The problem gets bigger and bigger because it is suggested to him, and the things that are suggested to him become part of his makeup, and he can't get set free in the name of Jesus. The secret is to take it all to Jesus. And it says the blood of Jesus Christ, his Son, cleanses us from all sin. God can not only take the problem away, but wash away the problem and wash away the guilt with his precious blood. And we had an old Chinese preacher through the country years ago, Leyland Wong was his name. His definition of a philosopher was a man who studies more and more about less and less until he knows everything there is to know about nothing. I have a daughter who's a bit of a philosopher, my eldest daughter Becky. She's a very smart girl, she really is. Out of the four of them, she sort of thinks very deeply. We used to travel in a vehicle, and every time we traveled we would philosophize on various subjects. And one day I said, Becky, I said, we'll stop, shall we? I said, I think we'll stop our philosophy class. Let's forget about philosophy, let's get into the Bible and see what God says. And you'll find you'll grow stronger if you'll see what God says and not try and philosophize about what men think is going on. Now, anybody who's involved in seances and Ouija boards, you need to be set free in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. Lifting of tables and so on. I was having a meeting in Henderson one night. You may remember this one, minor, down Henderson Road, I think at George Collins's place. You remember that? That was a dear man of God. And a young man stood up in that meeting and he said, can I speak? I said, yes. He said, one night we were playing with a glass on the table, you know, fingers on the glass, asking it questions. And he said, I'd heard about the name of the Lord. I thought I'd try something out. So I said, what can you tell me about the blood of Jesus Christ? And the next minute the glass went boom, and it flew to 1,000 pieces. He said, I got such a fright, so did all the others, we will never try that again. Some of you kids think it's funny doing that at school. Don't do it. It is dangerous stuff, and you will be in trouble if you continue to do so.
So wise words there from Barry Smith, bless him, for the New Zealand preacher. They're talking about philosophy in universities, really following on from, to a certain extent, the sort of, you know, the idea of extracting the spiritual from our understanding, which some of the universities do, and the idea of banning any input from the churches. Anyway, so time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also, the evictee fighting back, Ruth Nestor. And Barbara Cook from Bristol Outcry, as well as Dr. Judith Brown, the enigmatic Judith Brown, that doesn't go on Facebook that much anymore, but doing some brilliant work along with the ex-propaganda professor, that is Piers Robinson, and the New York radio journalist Don DeBar. Also, of course, to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page. And you can also do so via my Telegram channel, Tony Gosling Censored. You'll find the podcast, the full-length interviews, story links, the comments page, and our email addresses. And you can subscribe to my weekly email bulletin, newsletter, and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling, not holding out for Elon Musk. Thank you very much. Don't think he's going to contribute very much with his head implants to Twitter. My paperbacks, firstly about the deals between the Allies and the Nazis at the end of World War II, The Traitors of Arnhem. That's about Martin Bormann and the Bilderbergers. That's £15. Also my secret government anthology, From Cromwell to the Princess Diana Association, The Siege of Heaven Reader, both on eBay, and that is priced £20, The Siege of Heaven Reader. I think it's 350, 400 pages. That's an excellent, I think, excellent, although I edited it. It's not my writing. It's an anthology of other people's stuff for the last 350, 400 years. And then there's also, if you're interested, on the same eBay place is the Christian Socialist T-shirts, which is this design of Jesus as Che Guevara, which was actually, that was an artwork which was commissioned by the Anglican Church in Birmingham around about the year 2000 with one of my former colleagues. She got that on the bus shelters all around Birmingham to coax people into churches over Easter in 2000. So that's now just a design on the T-shirt as Jesus as Che Guevara. That's £15 from medium, large, extra large and double XL sizes. Just specify a size if you're interested in that. Or I think these things, wonderful Christmas presents, and you can help sponsor the show too by buying those. So this show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. That is to say the talkradio.org.uk stream, and over Sunday tea time at Camberley's radioqUK.com. Do please feel free to make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the PRSC in Bristol on talkradio.org.uk, at radioquuk.com in Camberley, Surrey too, and live on the Not the Glorious BCFM Politics Show app. Actually, if you're looking for it as an app, it's just Not the BCFM Politics Show. You can restream us live, or if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream, talkradio.org.uk and the app, at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the Illuminati banksters get you down.
That's the news now. The shipping forecast issued by the Met Office at 0505 today, Saturday the 27th of September. The general synopsis at 0100, low Norway 1005, expected Baltic 1001 by 0100 tomorrow. New low expected Dover 1015 by same time. Low southwest Fitzroy 1018, moving southeast and losing its identity.
Thank you.